I saw through your eyes. You never know for sure what another man's life is like. You let something in your body when the radio's up high. But when I was young, still hear it all the time. And how did it feel? When no one changed it, you're the one behind the wheel. Did you ever know all the hearts you would steal? Did you ever think all those dreams become real?
WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now.
It cannot take a lot.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joining me is Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
I didn't say welcome to the broadcast, because I was listening to these podcasts that we have. You can go to WRIF.com Tuesday at noon, and they'll be posted there, this show. And at the beginning of every single show, I say, welcome to the broadcast. Maybe that's not so bad.
I don't think it's a bad thing. I think people are probably pretty used to hearing it.
Well, welcome to the broadcast, everybody. It's our turn on Sunday night from 10 p.m. till 1 a.m., where it's talk and conversation, 313-298-WRIF.
You said 10 p.m.
Did I?
You did.
I did.
You're changing everything about this show tonight.
11 p.m.
All right.
Central time. 10 p.m. Central time. Because people are listening all over the country, all over the world. And if you're out of town, if you're out of the country, there's people listening in Australia. I know we've had people in South Korea.
Yes.
Where? Singapore.
Finland.
Shanghai. Finland. Yeah. Jacob. Hi. We haven't heard from him in a long time.
And, in fact, a friend of mine, Marty, is listening in Arizona.
Hey, Marty.
We're way back to the old high school days.
And
never heard the show.
A Riff listener forever, Leslie.
Leslie, yes.
Right here in Detroit.
She is a Riff rocker, and I ran into her at the big Stars and Stripes Festival that was held in Mount Clemens, which, for those around the world, a local community here. And she said she would be listening tonight, and she really loves the show. So thanks, Leslie.
Glad to give her a shout-out. You know, we have an email address for you when the lines are busy. In fact, I haven't even looked. Let me get my little mousey here, and we shall see. 313-298-WRIF. We have an introduced any subject, but hey, why depend on us? You can do it as easily as any one of either Jalene or I. But I got a lot of email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, where we usually get comments. People listening to the podcast that have said that the identical interview has run every single week for the last month.
No.
Yeah.
This is not good, and I shouldn't be laughing.
This was about the baseball great Satchel Paige. The African-American who was excluded, of course, from baseball for...
great interview.
Yeah, it was a great interview. Not four times in a row. So I met with the engineering staff here at WRIF. We listened to the podcast, and there was, in fact, the podcast that I had started. I mean, you're in here. I started manually. I start the correct one. And then what happens, the podcasts are prepared by recording off of the air. So it is impossible that that occurred. Yet I've gotten email after email saying,
"No kidding."
What? So, folks, I don't know what to say.
And we have really the best engineers, I think, in the entire country.
Well,
at this
also,
company.
It's almost like physically impossible. Well, what a week this was, and people. I mean, no one at any given period, I think, unless you know, you're in the midst of a revolution or something like that, or your country is being invaded by war, do you realize that we're making history right now? I think everybody, well, everybody that's listening now lived through September 11th, 2001. And so you have the sense of that was history. This is something that will always be in people's minds. They'll know that thing the way the generation before that knew exactly where they were when John F. Kennedy tried to kill them.
What?
You know, the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, gosh.
or when he was assassinated. One of the other. That's an old joke. let's see.
A new one to me.
Yeah, we have a Facebook page here at Night Call. We have a MySpace page. All you got to do is just do whatever you do for those things. I have no idea.
You know, really the only thing we don't do is tweet. We're not on Twitter. And I'm not going there.
No, but we would have to initiate.
Yeah, which means it's not happening.
Yeah.
No. If it weren't for Debbie in Northampton, those other two things wouldn't even exist.
Right. Debbie.
Oh, she rocks.
Debbie. Yeah,
yes.
She does. Absolutely.
In fact, so you're talking about the death of Michael Jackson, no doubt.
Well, let me just bring in a couple other, well, kind of lighter things.
Okay.
I told you, ever since we've gotten this big flat screen TV, I used to say, we never watch television.
Kill your television.
Yeah, kill your television. Now, man, our television is killing us. We're like, regular old Americans.
It's rocking. You're burning it up, huh, Peter?
Yeah. So we've got this big, well, actually, it's not that big,
I've seen it. It's,
what is it, 32, 36? I can't remember.
I don't know, but it's large. Yeah.
And so we got this introductory offer through Comcast, and so then they just doubled our rates. So my wife called him and said, man, we're blown out of here. We can't afford that. And they said, okay. And so like for $48 a month or something like that, for a two-year contract, they had given us everything including HBO.
The Playboy channel?
Not the Playboy channel.
Okay.
She had it blocked for me.
And we'll leave it at that.
Right. But there was a new series. Well, they had this thing, what was it called? True Blood? Vampire? Oh, man, we turned that off. That was too explicit, and I'm not talking about sex. I'm talking about people with their hearts ripped out.
Yeah, okay, vampires are hot right now,
I know,
Peter.
I know, but hearts ripped out, they're not real big in our household.
Not in mine either,
okay.
Thank you.
But there is this one that just started tonight that I saw about the first 5 or 10 minutes of that's set in Detroit. It's called Hung, H-U-N-G, and it's about a male prostitute set here in Detroit.
No
guys
kidding.
Wearing a Detroit Pistons T-shirt. They actually showed Tiger Stadium being demolished, walking in front of Lafayette, Coney Island, what else? The old train station and all that. So it was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
I mean, it just seemed, I looked at it, and I'm always preparing for the show when my wife is watching Desperate Housewives.
Right.
So it sort of seemed like the same thing.
Yeah, but really, this is a political show, even though we've talked really nothing about pop culture.
Yeah, let's see. Here, Roger, our phone screener who knows absolutely everything. Thomas Jane is the actor who is on the show, Hunged. I think it's just Hung.
I think it is Hung.
Yeah, Hung. Yeah, all right. Well, the death of Michael Jackson really, everything attended to that just shocked me beyond belief. And probably a lot of people who are rooted in the rock world or the blues world or the classical music world. In other words, if you're not into pop culture, if you didn't grow up with Michael Jackson being part of your sort of cultural, social life.
It was a soundtrack to a lot of people's lives.
It was.
Yes.
And, I mean, I'm certainly aware of him, both as a musician, actually as my union brother.
True.
And as was Farrah Fawcett, who passed away as well.
Yes.
And probably, what was the guy, the pitch man that passed away?
Oh,
Mason?
Billy Mays.
Mays, yeah.
Yeah.
But the Michael Jackson phenomenon just floored me. And one of the things that occurred to me, the whole thing always seemed such an absolutely odd phenomenon because the hooks in some of those songs seemed kind of infectious, but I'm not real into pop music.
Mm-hmm.
And I started listening to some of his music online.
Yeah.
And I went, it's okay.
Pretty good.
Well, I actually did not have that. I mean, it was okay. I mean,
were you listening to the hits?
The hits.
Okay, because there's a lot of other Michael Jackson special songs that you probably haven't heard that you may enjoy.
in the
about We Are the World? He tried to bring the world together. Come on.
I mean, I think ultimately he was a decent fellow that had just a streak, that a fatal streak in him, or a fatal flaw that that sent him down.
I mean, yeah, there, well, and there's so many theories. But, you know, someone looked at me today when I was down working and said, come on, Julian, the guy was a pedophile. Okay, and
was he? It's not clear.
He was acquitted.
He was well. Not only was he acquitted, but I was just reading this very long article by Ian Halperin in the London Daily Mail. That he says that he started, when he started doing stories on Michael Jackson about 10 years ago, he made the assumption, the same thing, that he was a pedophile, that, you know, that everything he said, he liked to sleep with young boys in their pajamas and what have you. But
And the Jesus juice, do you remember that?
No. No, yeah. I don't know.
He was accused of giving kids wine, and he called it Jesus juice.
I don't know. You know, none of this stuff I don't follow too closely. But I know within the rock world that Michael Jackson pretty much was an object of scorn and ridicule and contempt. Nothing like this outpouring of affection and grief and sense of loss that people I know that have told me that, I mean, I was kind of shocked at their response.
Yeah.
And they told me essentially, hey, either you had to be there or you weren't.
Right. I was there. I was there. And you know what? The one happy person in this whole thing is the governor of South Carolina.
That it blew that off the front page.
Right.
Let me just want to say a couple more things, though, about Michael Jackson. These are the headlines. I haven't even gone through this this article entirely. It's about 12 pages long. But and I don't have it on my website. My website is Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. There's a lot of other interesting stuff there that I'll talk about later. But this says that Michael Jackson had a genetic connection that had ruined his lungs and left him unable to sing. That this whole thing about he had the swine flu, remember,
mm-hmm.
was not true. That he thought he was agreeing to 10 concerts, and it turned out it was 50 concerts.
Right. Now, yeah, I heard he was awaiting a lung transplant. That's what,
really?
Yeah, that was something I read. I mean, there's so much flying out there, you know. And I wonder if our political listeners appreciate this conversation or don't. What do you think?
I don't know. They can say it one way or the other. You know, someone will say, why aren't you talking about Iran? Hey, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, we will.
313-298-WRIF. Apparently, he'd become so skeletal that doctors believed he was anorexic, that he was addicted to many drugs. I mean, for all the joy that he brought people, it was almost like he was a sacrifice.
Like he had, yeah, right, yeah. Exactly, that he had really none inside.
Well, and I don't know. I mean, I know how a lot of people conceive of him. I have no idea.
Listen, I think he was a real bizarre cat. I mean,
yeah.
He named his third child Blanket.
Really?
Did you know that?
He had three kids? I didn't know three. That.
He had two with the one woman, and I don't know about the third, but named it Blanket. Okay, so that's weird. He's eccentric. Yeah, I'm eccentric as well. I like eccentric people, you know?
Well, Michael Jackson was. But, you know, I don't think, well, maybe the eccentricity was part of the attraction, but a lot of that he was you know, sort of transracial, post-racial, that he himself evolved. I mean, I was thinking when I saw these photographs, like he was like 20 years old when his first big hit album came out in like 1979. I can't remember the name.
The Thriller?
No, before that.
Oh, before that.
And he
his solo.
He was this handsome African-American man,
mm-hmm.
right? And with many, retaining many African characteristics, although obviously, like most people of African origin in this country, is mixed with other races. And then, you know, you see all of a sudden, whoa, hello, Phantom of the Opera, you know, like, whoa.
And he became Diana Ross.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But as I said, that although there was that he was often the source of jokes and jests and...
For
rock and roll morning shows, gee, I'll bet Drew and Mike did a few here on WRIF. They did. In fact, I remember hearing the whole thing, but I won't even go into it. But he wasn't conceived as such by rockers. If people may remember that in 1982 in the Thriller album, the Beat It, the song Beat It featured Eddie Van Halen.
Yes, yeah, and he did a song with Slash.
He did a song with Slash from Guns N' Roses. In fact, two of them, one of his very important ones, Black or White, and then the other, Give It to Me. Carlos Santana was on Whatever Happens. So there was respect for him. as a...
as an artist.
Yeah, yeah. Billy Idol's guitarist was on one of the ones on Whiplash Smile. And here at WRIF, that there was a big decision had to be made about whether to play Beat It on Riff. Riff, this is back Riff history.
People are like, what?
Well, Riff was the center during the late 70s with J.J. and the Bruiser, and some of you old-timers will remember this, that of anti-disco sentiment.
Yes.
And there was the dread card. Detroit's resisting, what, I can't
and
remember.
And the people show me their dread cards all the time when I'm out at appearances.
So all of a sudden, to come on with, Beat It on WRIF, and so I remember, I think they played it for a while.
They did.
We did.
Right. Yes, you did. Yes, yeah. You did, Peter.
Well, moving on to Mark Sanford, the wayward governor of South Carolina.
Oh boy.
Do you know what L'Amour Fou is?
Okay, we've discussed this before.
L'Amour? You know what?
Love.
Love. The love of Fou. Crazy.
Crazy love.
Crazy love.
Oh yes.
And I believe that it was a term that was fashioned by the French surrealists, and many of you know what those folks were, but realists, you just put S-U-R in front of it, you can go Google that while we're talking, and they thought that if everybody acted upon their passions, that it would destroy bourgeois society. That it's only the retention of passion and lust and emotions that keeps this artificiality of and structure of this society together.
Wow.
So they were all about L'Amour Fou, so they would have loved Mark Sanford, because, you know, or another way to put it, his brain just dropped down into his...
Yeah, he's thanking with his thing, as my mother likes to say.
I mean, what was with this guy? Was it? Yeah, no one will find this out. I mean, it's like Clinton. It's like Clinton, you know? I mean, I can get away with this.
It's not like he tried to go to, like, the no-tell motel.
Yeah.
He went to another country, flew, took a trip. Hello.
And what was he? He was crying in... Argentina, didn't he?
He was?
Yeah, he was talking about, and what was, you know, what's...
Wait, don't cry, Evita?
Yeah. What's Lloyd Webber's first name?
Andrew?
Andrew, yeah, hadn't he ever seen Andrew? Probably had seen it too much.
Oh.
But it was like his, you know, his wife was, it sounded like she was kind of running the show. And I think, you know, this uptight, moralistic, right-wing Christian conservative thing. Rush Limbaugh, I saw a video of him holding his head in his hands and saying he could have been our JFK.
He did not.
He did.
Oh.
Mark Sanford could have been our JFK.
Oh, no. And Mark Sanford's one of these characters who wanted to preserve the sanctity of marriage, right?
Yeah
so let's deny gay people. But, hey, by the way, I'm going to be married, and I'm going to do whatever the hell I want. That's what he's saying. No, right. I'm never getting married again.
God, you scared me. I thought you were announcing on the air.
No.
I'm the last to know.
It's a promise.
Well, JFK, he could have been. He was on the road. John F. Kennedy's nickname was among his security guys.
He had a lot of them.
Mattress Jack.
Oh, my.
I mean, he was knocking them back in the White House. I mean, but it goes all the way back. Into the 19th century.
Yeah.
There was all these guys. I don't know whether they had a higher incidence of adultery just because they were powerful. And, I mean, even a creep like Henry Kissinger could bang Jackie Onassis, right?
Amazing.
He said, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
Oh, boy.
Dr. Strangelove.
You know, and I really could care less if these people have affairs. What bothers me is when they, exactly what I just said, you know, that they want to publicly preserve. Yes. Thank you. Hypocrisy makes me ill. Have your affair, don't have your affair, I don't care.
Yeah. One senior legislative staff member in South Carolina says, described her as, quote, the real brains behind the operation. You know, his whole deal.
Are we always? I mean,
but what a deal. This guy on Father's Day.
Oh, is this what happened?
Yeah, he has four sons. He's, you know, he's down there, Maria. And he said he was going to be hiking the Appalachian Trail.
Oh, yes.
Little did he know that it was nude hiking day on the Appalachian Trail the day he said he was going there.
So, do they really have that?
Yeah.
Be free, people. Be free.
Yeah. So let's see. Through a spokeswoman, Jenny Sanford declined request to be interviewed for this article in the New York Times, but she said she learned of her husband's affair early this year when she found a letter he had written. This guy wanted to get caught, right? There's no doubt about it. He wanted
it. Never
out.
Write it down.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. It's like Kwame Kilpatrick and how soon we forget, and what's her name?
Oh, yeah. That's terrible.
Yeah. We can write all this and no one will ever find these text messages.
Right.
Yeah. She told him to end the relationship, but he repeatedly asked permission to visit the woman in Argentina in the months that followed. Please.
Please, Mommy, let me go.
I just want to go down there and see her one more time. All the other kids are.
But listen, Mrs. Sanford's going to be okay, Peter. You know why?
Why?
Because she has the Lord.
She's got the Lord.
She's got the Lord on her side. She's going to be fine. She's going to thrive and survive.
That's what she said.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, she's rapping.
Yes, she was.
Well, anyway, he wanted permission, and Mrs. Sanford told the Associated Press, I said, absolutely not. I used to ask my wife all the time, can I go down to Argentina and have sex with somebody?
And yeah, please.
She said, okay.
Well, yeah. I mean, she's such an understanding lady.
But she said, I said, absolutely not. It's one thing to forgive adultery. It's another thing to condone it. And then last week when the governor told her he needed time alone to write, she had specifically warned him not to see his mistress. She said she was devastated when he went to meet her in Argentina. I think that's kind of a weird word, too. Argentina. Or not Argentina.
What?
Mistress. Mistress. I'm sorry. I'm reading ahead here.
The mistress. Brain is jumping way ahead of you tonight.
Isn't that not to see? What else could you call her? His friend.
His lover. Lover.
Yeah, that's kind of weird, too. Let's see. They've said who she is. Do you have that on the email? Maria, they have her. She's been all over the internet.
I do have that. She has admitted to the affair. Let's see. A 41-year-old Argentine former reporter acknowledged having a relationship with him. And she's decided to send the statement to clear up certain incorrect things that are being reported and put an end to the matter. As you imagine, it's very painful to me, my two children, my entire family, and close friends. Well, it wasn't painful when y'alls were doing it.
Yeah, right. Gail Collins, who writes great columns in the New York Times, wrote one on June 25th called The Love Party. And, oh, yeah, well, she said, maybe this is where I got it from, that he said, Governor Sanford.
Mark Sanford.
Thank you. Said, I spent the last 5 days crying in Argentina, he said, completely ignoring all we learned from Andrew Lloyd Webber. Sanford was widely regarded as a Republican presidential contender. Many of you may have forgotten this, but for a while in 2008, he was a serious candidate to be John McCain's running mate. Gail Collins says, we now stop briefly to contemplate the possibility that there were even worse options than Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
Now he's become the second GOP hopeful in a week to do a swan dive off the adultery cliff because this Senator Ensign from Nevada.
Yes.
That was the same thing. And she says, perhaps the party has been too strict about the no girlfriends while running for president rule. If they don't drop it, pretty soon the youngest contender will be 75.
Oh, no.
But again, as you said, Julian, it's just the hypocrisy that it's all about. And also, I don't understand the public confession. I can imagine that if I was in that position and got busted, I wouldn't be calling any press conference and, you know, with my wife at my side, I committed adultery. I've shamed my family. I've shamed my state.
Yeah, why do they do that?
I don't know.
I don't either.
I don't get it. I don't know. Self-flagellation. Which means
self-flagellation?
No. Flagellation. Whipping. Whatever.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I couldn't find, I don't know if you have it there in the articles, that they want him to resign and the lieutenant governor of South Carolina to take over. And I don't have it here, so I think his name is Bauer. And he was recently arrested for driving over 100 miles an hour and also had, in the last year or so, crashed a small plane. So he would take over.
Well, they need to get someone in line then again. Well, they'll have someone behind him.
Now, it's Charles M. Blow said he had a column called The Prurient Trap. And it says, at the end of the day, aside from the dereliction of duty and malfeasance, this, for me, he says, would be a private matter. That is, if it were not for the appalling hypocrisy of yet another social conservative saying one thing while doing another. There are Democratic sex scandals, to be sure, but Democrats didn't build a franchise on holier-than-thou moral rectitude. The Republicans did. They used sexual morality as a weapon. Now it's shooting them in the foot, in the feetsies, in the feets.
In the feets.
I mean, how many times can they? Sanford, by the way, Mark Sanford, the governor of South Carolina, voted to impeach Bill Clinton during the Monica Lewinsky saga. According to the Post and Courier of Charleston, Sanford called Clinton's behavior reprehensible and said, quote, I think it would be much better for the country and for him personally to resign.
Wow.
Let's see. But this kind of hypocrisy isn't confined to the politician. It permeates the electorate as well. While conservatives fight to, quote, defend marriage from gays, they can't keep theirs together. According to the Census Bureau's statistical abstract, states that went Republican in November accounted for 8 of the 10 states with the highest divorce rates in 2000. Mm. Six, conservatives touted abstinence-only education, which was a flop when real sex education was needed, most desperately in red states. According to 2006 data from Guttmacher Institute, those red states accounted for 8 of the 10 states with the highest teenage birth rates.
Jeez.
These, you know, as in a study titled Red Light States, Who Buys Online Adult Entertainment?
Yeah.
It was published and found that subscriptions to online pornography sites were, quote, more prevalent in states where surveys indicate conservative positions on religion, gender roles, and sexuality than in states where, in states where, quote, more people agree that I have old-fashioned values about family and marriage.
Well, it just doesn't work. I mean, really.
And the author says they could avoid this hypocrisy by focusing more on what happens in their own bedrooms. Hello!
What a concept!
Yeah. And avoiding the trap of judging what goes on in everyone else's. And actually, let's see, in the
New
York...
That's a great idea.
Yeah. So the states with divorce rates, the state with the highest divorce rate in the country is Nevada.
Oh,
which actually went Democratic this time. But then it's Arkansas, Wyoming, Oklahoma, Idaho, Kentucky, Alabama, Mississippi, West Virginia. Those are the ones with the highest teenage birth rates. The highest, Mississippi, Texas, Arizona, Arkansas, New Mexico in there, which went for Obama, Georgia, Louisiana. Subscriptions to online pornographic sites adjusted for broadband usage. What do you think? I mean, I don't know. I'm sorry. I know you hate when I ask you these questions because I know the answers and you don't. If you ask me, the state that's probably the most religious state in the country that is actually a theocracy, Utah.
Oh yeah.
Run by, has the number one highest number of subscriptions to online pornographic sites.
Well, they're also repressed, Peter.
Do you think? Then Alaska, but that's because of the long winters, and it's got, aren't the guys about like 14 to 1?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. That's, what do they always say, Alaska, where the men are men and the sheep are nervous.
Oh, no, you did not.
I didn't say that. Are we on the air?
Is this thing on? We are live.
All right, Mississippi's next, and Hawaii. I don't know why that, God, I don't know why. Then Oklahoma, Arkansas, North Dakota, Louisiana. Oh, those are the big porn states.
Yeah, what's up with Hawaii? That is...
No.
Good question.
Mark Sanford, who cares? Except, like I say, these people are just such crashing hypocrites.
Yes, and I think it needs to be talked about.
Well, maybe we're on the wrong subject because the phones aren't ringing off the hook. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Any comments about either Michael Jordan or
Michael
Sanford?
Jackson.
What did I say?
Michael Jordan.
Oh, yeah. Well, anybody wants to talk about Michael Jordan?
I'm writing a new song for you. It's called You Need Me.
What do I do when you're off? Who knows? I don't review the tapes.
I think sometimes I distract you, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it.
I've got a ton of little stories here, and I think I'm just going to go through them real... I'm not, you know, we'll take calls and
okay.
stuff like that.
Okay, give me a chance. It'll give me a chance to check up on the emails because okay. people are writing in.
Yeah, it is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. New Hampshire. The legislator voted to make New Hampshire the 14th state to legalize marijuana for severely ill people. But Governor John Lynch must decide whether to sign the measure. He's a Democrat. He says he has not read the final bill, but he remained concerned about allowing marijuana cultivation and distribution to spread. Yeah, because, people could change their consciousness as well as helping people that are really sick.
Scandalous.
Why don't we do this? We'll give people a chance to call.
Dial the number.
Yeah, 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, and we'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
When we wanted to give you more on the Riff, but we ran out of somewhere to put it all, we said, screw it. Let's make a whole nother radio station.
What's that sound?
Riff 2. It's music made for the Motor City and totally commercial free. Log on from anywhere in the world at Riff2.com.
The international record labels are asking Congress for a handout, and they want to take it from your local radio stations. That may mean stations like this one have to cut back on the music we play or the community services we provide. Representatives Thaddeus McConner and Mark Schauer can help by sponsoring a bill to keep the radio you love free from a performance tax. Call today and ask them to sponsor the Local Radio Freedom Act and oppose a performance tax on free radio. And thank you to Representative Mike Rogers for his support of free radio. Learn more at noperformancetax.org. This message furnished by the NAB and this station.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the only attorney-driven program dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief, 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
Please stay tuned to the following public announcement. The government and private banks are liquidating houses now. These houses have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and will be sold. Homes may be sold for very little money down. To learn how to receive a free list of foreclosures, call 800-354-8211. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N are allowed to start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes quickly, so listings may not always remain available in all areas. So act now. I repeat, this is a public announcement. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N can start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Call CRN's national toll-free hotline to learn how to receive your free foreclosure list at 800-354-8211. That's 800-354-8211.
Attention! Hydralyze is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles or bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are eligible to see results and participate in the Hydralyze trial. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away, watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience results with Hydralyze. Call this number today, 1-800-505-7931. Once more, that's 1-800-505-7931.
When it's hot outside, make sure you're staying cool inside with a new air conditioning system from Sears. Just go to heatandcool.com and save $350. It's a hot offer that's getting hotter because now you can get a tax credit up to $1,500 from the government's 2009 stimulus package. Details at energystar.gov. Sears has a full line of Kenmore and Carrier cooling systems. You can trust Sears for reliable service and installation. And when you go to heatandcool.com, you can save $350. So stay cool, save energy, and save money with Sears. Just go to heatandcool.com. Offer ends June 30th. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. That's heatandcool.com. Or click the Sears banner on your screen. Save $350 on a new air conditioning system from Sears. Go to heatandcool.com.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. And when you call now, we'll also send you our Green Tea Moisturizer, a feather-light serum that absorbs instantly to deliver deep hydration for free. Call 1-800-335-4191. Our combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put Proactive to the test, and we'll prove it. Get your free soothing green tea moisturizer with your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now. 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. This is the phone-in talk show. Our numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And we have an email address as well, calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
To which our good friend Winston Smith wrote in.
Okay.
And said, Michael Jackson was an anomaly, a somewhat musically talented sideshow freak whose dancing resembled an epileptic seizure. I disagree with that. I thought he was a great dancer. But he says this is the part that that I felt was important. The media attention to his passing exceeded that of the 9/11 attack and reflects the prevailing American mentality. No wonder this country's falling apart. Which leads me to, you know, I'm just completely addicted to Facebook. And Debbie in Northampton, who takes care of our Facebook page, our fan page, and also our MySpace, had put her update during, it was the day, or I think that night, you know, after he had passed. And all she wrote was, pop culture. And it just hit me like a brick, you know. I just thought, okay, I get it, because really, let's look at Iran and just, you know, name a country, name a situation, sure. Iraq, Afghanistan, or whatever, and it really did kind of smack me in the face, so I thought, okay, he deserves attention, and a lot of it, and I believe, but really, what's going on in the world is something that we should be way more hyped up about in our daily lives.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I know you and I are, and you know, a lot of our listeners are.
If you said to people, you know, when Michael Jackson and Farrah Fawcett died, that at the same time probably 10,000-20,000 children starved to death, or that any number of civilians were killed in Afghanistan and Iraq, people go, yeah. But there's something. I mean, the depth of the emotions that came out about the passing of Michael Jackson is something. But I want to just do one more technical thing. This is from Terry in Seattle. This is Peter and Jolene, the repeats of the Satchel Paige interviews. This is on the podcast, so although, get this, is something we don't know what's happening. The same interviews that come on at 1 a.m. Eastern time keep playing, I guess. They were on the live stream as well as the podcast. Seems like the problem was with how the third hour is being set up at the station. Well, it could be because I'm setting it up here at the station. I just set it up, and if the same interview, if the Satchel Paige interview runs again, I don't know what to say.
Because you're usually probably asleep by then. Right?
By what? By 1:30?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Close to it.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, I want to say hi to Sunfrog. who's Sun listening Frog. In Tennessee. He said he'd love to call to talk about Michael Jackson, the Stonewall anniversary, marijuana, and Obama. And I'll send you that information that you need there, Sun
Frog. All right. Yes, I want to get the Frogster on, for sure. Here's a little, I said I was going to do all these little bits here. On the 26th, that was what, Friday night? I can't even do the math. Friday night, yeah. The 1968 Chicago riot cops held a reunion. This is like an SS reunion or something like that.
Oh,
yeah, they
okay.
were saying that they were the only thing that stood between Marxist street thugs and public order was this thin blue line of dedicated, tough Chicago police officers that were just, well, I mean, we've seen enough historical footage of that. There was also, though, a counter demonstration, which I did not hear anything about. It was put together by Chicago. Cop Watch, and you got to remember too, is that the cops of Chicago of 40 years ago were this. Not only were they this corrupt, absolutely thoroughly corrupt bunch, but they were brutal and they were murderous.
Sounds like Philadelphia.
Yeah, they assassinated the Black Panthers, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, and the idea that these guys would actually have the temerity to meet again to celebrate what they did is just absolutely disgusting.
A quick thing, you know, the Tigers played the Cubs this week, and I was
right.
doing an appearance before a game the other night, and this one lady who was a Cubs fan looked at us and said something, at least we don't burn our city down, and I looked at her and I go,
what is she talking about?
I go, really?
I mean, like what, 42
yeah,
years
yeah,
ago?
Yeah, wasn't there like a really big fire in Chicago?
Yeah, well, that was just... Oh,
you know what
Mrs.
I'm saying.
Mrs. O'Malley, yeah, but they had a big Chicago riot.
I know.
Go home, lady.
Yeah,
how did they do?
Home.
I know there was that one...
We beat them.
Yeah, there was that pinch hit...
I don't know the details.
Okay,
I just know
right.
we did well.
Let's go to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. This is Kevin in Detroit on Michael Jackson. Kevin, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing, Pete?
Good.
Yeah, I'm happy to listen to you.
I'm great. Thank you, Peter.
Since 1985, and I'm a black guy. I'm talking about just the things for Michael Jackson. Like, I do believe that he did break down barriers in the music industry, even though MTV was very reluctant to play black music, no matter how successful you were.
Well, he really made MTV. He pioneered those videos. Quincy Jones is genius involved in that, of course.
And you know what? He also made the most expensive video to this day in music history, $7 million. And what was the name of that song? Do you remember, Kevin, the one he did with Janet? It was the video all in black and white, and it was Stop Pressuring
Crap,
Me.
I didn't remember that one.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
But like I'm saying, no matter how rock and roll you were to be black, you wouldn't play it. And then Prince came after that. Well, like I said, I do firmly believe this, that a white artist or a white singer can play R&B music, be more accepted among a black audience than the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that, no matter how rock and roll you are. I mean, what's the difference between what Kenny Wayne Shepherd has played nothing but the blues from Stevie Ray Vaughan and what Albert King and all them have done? Even though Eric Clapton and people like Steve Winwood have always given black artists credit because they were accepted over there in England as opposed to being accepted in the U.S.
Well, if you think about it, Kevin, in many ways, integration began in the music industry. I mean, we even back into the teens and the 20s, but then you think about Benny Goodman and Billie Holiday and Benny Goodman, the clarinetist, he had African Americans in his group, and that was like, whoa, that was breaking some ground.
Wonderful.
All right, Kevin, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's see, here's Ed is in Warren. Ed, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Hey, Jelaine, how you guys doing?
Hi, Ed.
We're doing good.
Great, thank you.
Hey, I talked to you guys a few months ago. It's been a while, but I'm glad you guys took my call. I just want to say, you know, I tend to vote and think of myself more as a conservative than some people, I guess. And it really bothers me that this happens with, you know, like Governor Sanford. Why this happens, you know, if you're not happy in your marriage, get a divorce. It's a perfectly acceptable thing to do. That's what people do if it's not working out.
Well, wait a minute, Ed. Isn't there sort of a pattern here with conservative preachers and politicians?
Yeah, You know what? There kind of is. It's, you know, like the one that got caught up in the gay scandal out there in Colorado. I forget what his name is.
Ted Haggard.
Yeah. Well,
thank you.
Old Mark Foley and, I mean, these guys.
Old Senator Wide-Stance.
Oh, yeah. Remember Senator Wide-Stance from Idaho?
Sorry. We can't help ourselves.
Idaho?
Oh, no.
You know, hey, now, listen, you guys. I'm agreeing with you guys.
Okay. We're just
it really
having fun.
Me We're just we pull this because it lets me down. You know what I mean? It gives liberals fodder to use constantly, and it's like, come on, let's clean up our act here. You say this, and then look what happens. You don't even practice what you preach.
Well, Ed, the thing is that you just shouldn't be self-righteous because, I mean, the problem, for instance, with what's with these governors? I mean, the governor of New York, Mark Spitzer, who, am I saying that name right? Yeah Mark Spitzer.
No, it's
Spitzer.
But you know, wasn't Elliot?
Elliot Spitzer.
Yeah. Who's Mark Spitz was that Olympic swimmer. We're on a roll tonight.
Oh, yeah. Get it all. Elliot Spitzer.
It's okay, Reed. Yeah. I'm over here for you.
Thank you, Kathy. Or is it her?
Kelly.
Kelly
yeah.
Now. All right. And then what was it, McGreevy, who the governor of...
That one.
I can't remember. Let's call him John. John McGreevy.
Okay.
The governor of New Jersey who fell in love with this Israeli poet. But the thing was, with each of them, they were involved in, like, McGreevy, like, appointed this guy to some $100,000 a year job. So that's corruption.
That was the one, that had the boyfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Elliot Spitzer, I mean, he had always opposed prostitution, not on moral basis, but the fact that this was, you know, what do they call it? Something slavery?
Sex
slavery. Yeah, and also money laundering and all that. And here's this guy, you know, paying and what was he thinking?
Paying prostitutes.
What were they thinking? No one will ever know.
For real.
Yeah.
Yo, it's getting
crazy. All right,
especially...
good luck on those conservative politicians. The whole thing is, though, for them to stop, as we were reading earlier, to stop the crap, you know, to just, they should be as moral as they could be, and...
yeah, like, you know, who sets the moral ground? I mean, really?
Yeah.
Anyway, I agree with you.
We got a lot of out-of-state listeners. Here's Lush Limbaugh in New York. Go ahead,
wow.
You're on the air.
Yeah, so good evening, Peter. You may know my voice, you may not, but I definitely have a few bones I need to pick.
Okay.
With liberals like you. First of all, last year I made $25 million.
You did.
Okay?
You made a lot of money.
Wow.
That is enough money to buy 200,000 bottles of OxyContin. That's a good month's supply.
Yeah.
Now, next. As for all this hoopla with Sanchez and what you're doing is you are creating a war against infidelity, and we will not stand for that.
Stupid hell. So you support Lamar Fu, Crazy Love, right?
You bet your sweet stolen stock exchange funds I do.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lush.
Well, I have had just about what I'm going to take of you liberals, and you trying to get in the way of outsourcing our relationships, our mistresses.
Well, we just want you to stop being hypocrites. You can lay whoever you want, Lush.
There's no hypocrite about it. You liberals are destroying. It is your fault that there's a hole in the ozone. It is your fault that the government has to take over General Motors.
Really?
This is ludicrous.
He likes penis.
Oh, no. We can say that word.
What?
I think that Lush had a friend with him, and he said he likes penis.
That's all right.
We didn't even have to
That's
dump
right.
that one.
Thanks, Lush. Appreciate it.
Now we know the truth.
As widely expected, here's more proof that crime does pay. I mean, we know that just in the you know the biggies with all the bailouts. But also, Vice President Dick Cheney, the ex-Vice President, Darth Vader, has signed a deal with an imprint of Simon & Schuster to write a memoir about his life in politics and his service in four presidential administrations. $2 million advance.
No kidding.
All right, let's get those other out-of-state calls. If you're in Warren in Detroit and Westland, you hold on and we'll get you. Here's Andy in Tennessee. What city are you calling from, Andy? You're on the air.
Cookeville, Tennessee.
Cookville.
Cookie Town, as I like to call it.
Yeehaw.
Hi,
sorry,
Andy.
Sorry.
Well, you know, I took down the Obama poster today.
You did?
In my apartment.
Oh, yeah. We've spoken before. You were the big Obama fan.
Well, not really. Well, yeah, fan was the right word. I like him like I like a good writer, but not so much like a politician, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, we took down the posters because of the disappointments that he couldn't even. I'm not talking about the coup in Honduras or the fact that he supports, you know, the same global capitalist agenda as his predecessor. These things, you know, we understood these things, but I thought he could sort of make do on a couple of good sort of liberal promises. And the one that I'm most sad today about is his lack of support for basic civil rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered persons. That just seemed like such an easy and inexpensive thing that he could do, and he's not even willing to really do just that. And I thought it was interesting that today's the anniversary of Stonewall, the birth of the modern gay lib movement, and it's also the weekend that we're mourning, I guess, a person you could consider to be transgendered, Michael Jackson. We're, you know, having to remember that people who are different as far as the way they express their sexuality are still really not afforded basic rights that the rest of society enjoys.
And well, that's sure true. In fact, there was just an article in the Times, I didn't print it out, that said that that politics are lagging behind public attitudes, that people are just more and more okay. Isn't that nice? Willing to give everyone all their rights? But that's been the whole history of this country, is the expansion of rights so that it includes everybody. Inclusiveness is if you want to have a democratic society, everyone has to enjoy equal rights. And there's always been, of course, the conservative fight against that. They wanted to keep, the conservatives wanted to keep at the origins of this country that the vote restricted to white propertied males. And they, of course, supported slavery. They opposed the women's right to vote and on and on. But let me, Andy, get back to your contention that it would be something easy for Barack Obama to lead or to have policies that would make the promise of civil rights for everybody so for gay people. I think that would be a political explosion right now, and I think for political reasons, and even with elections coming up next year, that he's not going to go there in his first term.
Disappointing.
Well, you're right, you're correct, but don't you think it was politically expensive and challenging and difficult for the civil rights legislation to get signed by the Johnson administration in 64. I mean, you were around then. Don't you think it was politically hard for the
I was a baby. Come on.
He was only like three.
No, because it was on the agenda then. The country was exploding. And that's exactly what I've said about everything, is that nothing is going to change. Barack Obama is going to be an American president cut from the mold that most of them are. I mean, George Bush was an exception. I mean, a far right wing incompetent that wrecked everything. And well, okay, I'll leave it at that.
War criminal.
Yeah. But it is the reason that that all of a sudden this Southerner who was elected originally, Lyndon Baines Johnson, from a segregated state where blacks couldn't vote, was because suddenly there was an explosion in this country of a civil rights movement. I know there's a gay rights movement, but it's not certainly taking on the proportions or challenging society in the manner that it did back in the 50s and the 60s, or the civil rights movement did in the 50s and the 60s. Are you with me?
I think people will know in October, I think it's October 10th, there's going to be the first large national march on Washington for LGBT rights since 1993, right after the Clinton election. I hope that Obama will do better than Clinton. He's meeting with gay leaders tomorrow, but right. I read the same pieces in the New York Times that you're referring to today, and politicians are politicians, and they do what's political. It's in their nature. I just find that this is something that he spoke out so eloquently on the campaign trail about, actually supporting full rights for LGBT persons, and he's really backpedaled on that. Now, I understand that he supported civil unions and not marriages, but the one contention is overturning DOMA, which would then allow...
The Defense of Marriage Act, yeah.
Yeah, that would allow those civil unions to include the basic privileges and benefits of marriage, even if you don't call it marriage.
Well, he's not going to do that now. It's like I say, that with so much on his plate, I'm not defending him. I'm describing this. I mean, he is a centrist politician. He's interested in getting more and more Democrats elected. I mean, of course, if he does that, perhaps he will have the ability to pass more progressive legislation. But the failures so far of him to differentiate himself from Bush in some regards has been very dramatic. In other regard, like civil liberties mm-hmm. and stuff like that, has been very disappointing. You know, I have no option right now, Andy, other than to say thank you for calling, because I have to do these commercials before midnight. So, hey, thank you for being down there in the Bible and calling in to the show. He gone. He takes.
Yep. Yeah, okay.
All right, I'm out of here.
Bye bye.
All right, goodbye. 313-298-WRIF.
318-9743.
On 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
On your Apple iPhone 3G, at the iTunes Store. Download the free WRIF app. Connect with just one touch and listen to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Is it wrong that I was totally aroused by that?
Details at WRIF.com. From 101.
Do you owe taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? What will you do? Your tax problem will only get worse if you don't do something about it. If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Pick up the phone and call 1-800-493-8157. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe. Remove penalties and interest, and get the tax collector off your case. As an honest, hard-working American, you do have rights. Don't let your tax problem get worse. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
You may have seen her on Oprah or The View. We're talking to Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center, about a powerful free tape she's giving away to help people discover a way to leave anxiety and depression behind for good. Lucinda, what are some of the symptoms of anxiety?
Worry, fear, depression, insecurity, low self-esteem. I suffered with anxiety and depression for over 20 years. When I was at my lowest point, I was curled up in a ball on my living room sofa, afraid to live and afraid to die.
Wow. So what's the biggest anxiety myth?
I think the most challenging thing about working with people with anxiety and depression is that many of them think they're victims of their emotions. They think they'll always be worrisome, fearful, and depressed.
But that's not true.
There's real drug-free help that has the potential to last a lifetime. Millions of people have called for this wonderful free tape.
Okay, to request your free tape, call 1-800-550-6146. 1-800-550-6146. 1-800-550-6146.
I looked at her and I was just, wow, she looked so young.
I told her I couldn't believe how smooth her face looks. She's lost, what, 10 years at least?
I looked at her and it's like I'm looking at a picture of my wife from 20 years ago. It's incredible.
How are ordinary women across America looking years younger? They've discovered the proven breakthrough called Hydroxytone. It erases wrinkles, tightens skin, and makes frown lines disappear from view. See for yourself by requesting a free trial of Hydroxytone today. The results are so impressive. Hydroxytone was given away in VIP gift bags at international film festivals. Try Hydroxytone risk-free and shed years from your appearance faster than you thought possible.
She always looked good to me, but now I can't believe how young she looks.
Call now for your free trial of Hydroxytone. For a limited time, try it before you buy it. 1-800-630-3327. But hurry, when this offer's gone, it's gone. Call 1-800-630-3327. 1-800-630-3327.
Feel the need for speed with a rip.
All right!
Even
luck on 101 WRIF all this weekend. To score your free tickets to the Chrysler Jeep Superstore's Detroit ABBA Gold Cup Races, July 10th through the 12th on the Detroit Riverfront. One lucky roof winner will also score a VIP package, including upgraded seats, fit passes, and parking. Go to www.gold-cup.com for more info and to purchase tickets. The Riff, Speed for Speed Weekend.
Listen and win.
From 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-337-1442. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know that this is the world's fastest easy learn a language. Choose 30 ones and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-337-1442. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-337-1442. That's 1-800-337-1442.
Play ball! Now pitching, Dave Black.
Dave is about to catch his opponent off guard. Not with his nasty fastball. No, instead of a fastball, we'll be hurling a tomato.
And the pitch.
Ooh. Using tomatoes as baseballs won't go over well with anyone. But if you're looking to hit the ball further and throw better, eating a healthy diet that includes fruits and vegetables is a home run. Packed with nutrients, they could help keep your body healthy and strong, giving you the energy you need to hit that grand slam. When you look at it this way, eating tomatoes is playing hardball against the competition. Run, throw, think, eat better. Can your food do that? Find out at smallstep.gov.
That's smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Joined by Julian Jordan. It's the witching hour, right? The midnight hour.
It is.
However you look at it. Our phone number is here on Night Call, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Our email is calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Joe in Farmington Hills wrote to us, and this is something that it even went through my mind earlier, to be honest. He said this week we saw the passing of Ed McMahon, Farrah Fawcett, Michael Jackson, and now Billy Mays. But the death that I'll always remember the most is that of a 27-year-old Iranian woman named Nida.
Yeah, I think probably most people have seen that either on television or the internet. This woman that was killed by the repressive forces of the government of Iran. One nation, under God, for sure. There. Tragic. At 1 a.m. tonight, if everything goes right, and rather than the same interviews being repeated by a ghost in the machine, I'm going to be interviewing Michael Clare, who has written Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. Wow. But anyway, he's going to talk about how the world demand for oil will soon outstrip the supply and what that means, what the consequences for our economy and for war and all. It's kind of he's pretty mild-mannered, but it's a pretty frightening interview when you think about the consequences of it.
Reality is frightening.
Reality bites.
Right? Yeah.
Then Richard Grossman, who has written Defying Corporations, Defending Democracy, says President Obama's new rules on the financial system won't do much. And again, that's not real sexy stuff, but it's about our lives. It's about what's going to be happening in the economy.
And the sexy part is when we're live. Let's admit it.
What?
The sexy part is when we're here live.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, yeah, right. The Congress, as you may recall, has recently just passed $100 billion more for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We always called them Bush's wars. Are they now Obama's? I guess so. But this article, whenever I hear about these expenditures and then the fact that this country doesn't have enough money for this or that, But here, crash puts focus on aging rail fleets. The train that rear-ended another in Washington on Monday evening, killing 9 people, was made up of some of the oldest cars in Washington's relatively young subway system, cars that have been cited for vulnerabilities before. The federal data show that many other cities are also using outdated rail equipment. More than a third of the equipment in the nation's 7 largest rail transit agencies was rated as marginal or poor condition by the Federal Transit Administration. Replacing all the equipment that has exceeded its useful life and finishing all outstanding station rehabilitations for just those 7 large systems would cost roughly $50 billion. Whoa, man, where are we going to get that? We don't have that kind of money.
Yeah, guess why.
$100 billion for war.
Right.
That's $100 billion for war. Let's
and
see.
As I always say, if you are not enraged about that, I don't know what's going on with
our,
you.
Our pal Harvey Wasserman, let me see, it's solartopia.org, like solar and then topia.org.
Mm-hmm.
He's the author of the book, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. Let's see, the fatal crash in the D.C. metro system underscores the critical funding needs faced by our ailing mass transit system. The crash of America's auto industry reflects more than bad management. It signifies an epic shift from car to light rail. Passenger train service, both between and within our cities, holds the key to a green future. This is where the Obama administration must refocus its attention. If Detroit is to be remade, it must be building passenger rail cars rather than private automobiles. And that, where did I see that about these corporations that have too tight a focus? Like, for instance, if the railroad companies would have called themselves transportation companies in mm-hmm. beginning in the 1890s. They could have made cars. They could have made planes.
Wow.
Right?
Hadn't thought about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's some choices to be made. And I think about it. We, my wife and about 6 others of us went down to, what was it called, Midsummer's Night Midtown. This has been like 12 days of entertainment. And on Friday night, we have this little saying in Detroit, each one drive one. Sometimes there's just single individuals. Well, we at least there was a few of us in each car. But on Friday night at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, MOCAD, down right near the Detroit Institute of Art, I saw Serbian, what was it, Slavic Soul Party.
Wow.
A 10-piece Serbian band that just stretched out beyond that and just blew the whole place apart.
Lots of energy.
Incredible
Sounds
energy.
Great, Peter.
And that was, it was. I thought, I can't imagine more energy the next night until we saw, I can't remember the name of the band.
The Cuban hip-hop band.
A Cuban hip-hop
right?
band. And I've never really been much into hip-hop, but man, we just danced for like an hour and a half, 500 people, you know, put your hands up, Detroit.
Right.
That's the only words in English they knew.
Yeah, well, you know what? They know that this is the rockin'est town on the planet, so there.
Oh, by the way, we were talking about Iran, and Iranian superstar Andy Mehdadian went into an L.A. recording studio recently with John Bon Jovi, Richie Sambora, and producer Don Was, and they recorded this musical message of worldwide solidarity with the people of Iran called Stand By Me. You know the old Benny King?
I do.
And that actually John Lennon has a good version of it. And the video of it is on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Oh, it also has rating the greatest GOP sex scandals of the past 20 years.
Oh,
because the Mark
now that's sexy.
Yeah, Mark Sanford. And also University of Michigan's Juan Cole. What's the name of his informed sources, I think? Michael Jackson, Islam, and the Middle East. Well, the Middle East is actually his major focus. So a lot of stuff on my website. I'm not selling anything. The reason I send people there is because stuff I see there is interesting to me as well. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Marty and Warren. Marty, thanks for joining me. Peter and Jolene, you're on the air with us on WRIF.
Hey, great, Peter. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Listen, dude, I've been listening to you for a long time. Were you ever on WTSX?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. I'm a huge fan of yours. I like the way you analyze things and answer things. And your new partner seems to be working out pretty well, too.
We have her on audition, but she's doing pretty good. Well,
and I'm not that new, but to this show on the air, Peter and I had a syndicated show for quite a few years, and I've been his quote-unquote producer since 98. We've been together a long time.
So 11 years. Yeah, but thank you. We're just kidding, Marty. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, let me tell you one thing. In terms of the other station, if you go to my website, if you have the Internet access, just go to Peter Werbe, Werbe.com, and go down the left side of it, and you'll see something that I don't want to talk about on the air. On this station, at least. But go ahead.
All right. Okay.
Wait. What is this? You sounded like Darth Vader there for a minute. What was that odd noise?
Maybe my phone caught a bit of static or something.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I don't know. Okay, here's the deal. I'm a smoker, okay?
Yeah.
And,
you're a midnight toker.
I just heard that song today.
Little Steve Miller Band. Yeah.
Okay. I've learned as smokers over the years that a lot of people are making their own cigarettes now. They go to a cigarette store, they buy a 24-ounce bag of tobacco, which used to be $17.99, is now $39.95.
Yeah, 60% they raised it.
Taxes?
Yeah.
That's because of the goddess of the underworld of state control of which we live.
Right.
Even a 6-ounce bag of tobacco used to be $7.99. Now that's $20.
Oh, my God. Woo. Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Well, here, these tobacco companies hook people. I mean, tobacco has almost 100% addiction rate. We talked about this a couple weeks back. Something like crack has like 30%. And most of the real addictive drugs that we think of as the real terrible problems, heroin and crack and stuff like that, it has an addiction rate that should make people consider what they're doing. But tobacco has a 100% addiction rate, and then they tax you so that you know they can finance things like children's health.
Yeah, well, listen, let me take this a step further, okay? I'm a commercial pesticide applicator. I've been treating lawns for about 12 years now. Every 3 years, I have to recertify through the Department of Agriculture for $75 just if I want to practice for the next 3 years, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, now, if the government, I want to know what you think about this idea. Why doesn't the state of Michigan start selling fireworks, okay?
Yeah.
Now, I'm not done yet, but in order to get those fireworks, people would have to go through the state of Michigan, study a manual, become certified, and also buy first aid kits and study the first aid things, and the state of Michigan could charge you $50, maybe $250 for a course. I don't know. Could you see a lot of revenue?
No. I can see a few thousand dollars. I mean, last night at this concert I was telling you about, this Cuban hip-hop group, there were people blowing off some major fireworks right close. And in my neighborhood, just as I was leaving, there was major fireworks. So, but I don't know.
I heard those.
We will take that under advisement. Thank you, Marty.
That was quite the conversation. We had fireworks, we had pesticides, and we had ciggies.
Yeah, ciggies and applying pesticides. Wow. 313.
Don't do it at the same time.
298. WRI. Yeah. You may remember last week, in fact, about this time, that I was talking about this Michigan Supreme Court decision that said that judges had the authority to over how witnesses dressed after a Muslim woman refused to remove her veil while testifying in a small claims case. And he said, if you won't remove your veil, that I'm dismissing the case. He did, and the Michigan Supreme Court upheld that dismissal. I said, you can't have it both ways. You can't be veiled in this traditional manner, where in countries where that's tradition, the men represent the women's interests.
And I didn't agree.
I know.
But I mean, this
and
is
people
very,
thought it was illiberal of me to.
It's very rare that.
But here. And maybe I'm being conservative because a conservative French president, President Nicolas Sarkozy, called Sarkozy, by Bush, Sarkozy said on Monday that the burqa, full-length coverage for Muslim women, the burqa was not welcome in secular France, condemning the head-to-toe cover as a symbol of subjugation rather than the Muslim faith. Well, it's both.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you know, you're talking to a raging feminist over here. No one could agree with that more, but it is their thing.
Yeah, and he said the burqa is not a sign of religion, it's a sign of subservience. Well,
yeah. I agree.
It is. It's a sign of, I mean, they're required in some cases
right.
to wear it.
But it appears subservient. It makes me sad.
Mm-hmm. Obama said, Obama this month, President Obama, defended the choice of some Muslim women to wear the Islamic headscarf. He said, quote, it's important for Western countries to avoid impeding Muslim citizens from practicing religion as they see fit. For instance, by dictating what clothes Muslim women should wear. Now, in France, let me see if I have this sentence here,
This is about the school children?
Well, he said, yeah. Sarkozy said, civil servants must not wear any outward sign of their religion, whether they are Catholics, Jewish, Orthodox, Protestants, or Muslim. Adding that a woman could wear a headscarf, provided it was her own decision.
Hmm.
But, there's been so much religious strife in countries. I mean, think about the religious strife that people would do well to just have this, their private thing, their own temple or synagogue or church or whatever else people go.
I don't know. This is a complex one.
Okay.
I mean, I'm all over the map on that one.
All right. Here's Jeff in Westland. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, Peter and Julian. How are you guys doing?
Hi, Jeff. Good. Great.
Hey, I just got back from that concert in Mount Clemens. It was pretty bizarre. The docking was, like, really belligerent when there was a lot of kids there. That was really weird to me. It was like, what?
Belligerent?
A drunk rock star? Come on.
No, he just dropped a lot of F-bombs and there was a lot of kids there, and I thought that was bizarre.
Yeah.
But that's not the point I was calling for. I just, about the Monica Conyers thing.
Right.
I mean,
Wait. Let me just bring people up to speed on that because people are listening all over the world. Monica Conyers was a city council member. Detroit city council member. She's also the wife of Representative John Conyers. She pled guilty on Friday to a felony charge of conspiracy to commit bribery and accepted cash-filled envelopes outside of McDonald's in exchange for her tie-breaking vote on a city sludge contract. She had been publicly against it. She all of a sudden changed her mind a week before the vote, and the Detroit Council voted 5-4 to approve the council in November 2007. It all began falling in on her when other people started copying pleas and naming her. So go ahead. That's the background.
Yeah, her mugshot, she looked pissed. But anyway, I was just wondering.
She usually does seem pissed.
Yeah, well, she took the D-bag away from Palin. But anyway, I was just wondering.
Oh, you know what he means.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
the D-bag.
Yeah,
but anyway, I was just wondering what you thought about what was going on with North Korea. They may bomb us or something.
I think we're safe. I mean, who knows? Those people are truly crazy. And one of the things is, you know, like Saddam Hussein, as we know now, that did not have weapons of mass destruction, and all that was based on just fabrications, outright lies by the Bush mob. But because if he really would have had weapons of mass destruction, the United States never would have invaded them. The fact that North Korea appears to have nuclear weapons, there, you know, let's negotiate. Let's negotiate. But unless those people are totally crazy, because if they ever did launch anything, the slightest attack at the United States, it'd be gone. Because, as I've said so many times before, the United States has battle plans for attacking and occupying every country on the face of the earth. And believe it, that the North Korea plans are sitting right up there on the Joint Chiefs of Staff desk at a time like this. All right, thank you very much. Well, sticking with legal news and in the document, Bernard Madoff will be stripped of all of his possessions under a $171 billion forfeiture order handed down only days before prosecutors seek to put the disgraced financier away in prison for the rest of his life. He's one of the ones that got caught. Right? The ones that haven't got caught are just still out there. I thought that he had made off with like $60 billion. Wasn't that the figure? Does he have $171 billion worth of stuff? I mean, can we have a little redistribution of wealth, please? Could you give us $50 billion so we could fix the transit systems and people don't get killed like they did in D.C.?
You know, he doesn't need money anymore.
No, because he's going to be a guest of the state.
Yes,
the prosecutors want 150 years. The guy's 71. I don't think they, I mean, that's a little harsh. I don't think they give him any more than 40. And but even his lawyers are asking for 12. And in federal prison, I don't think there's parole anymore.
12?
Well, yeah.
Oh, please.
Means it's too low?
Yes.
I don't care what happens to the guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But the U.S. District Judge ruled that Madoff must give up his interest in all property, including real estate, investments, cars, and boats. According to Friday's orders, the government also settled claims against Madoff's wife. Under the arrangement, the government obtained Ruth Madoff's interest in all property, including more than $80 million worth that she had claimed was hers. Now, I mean, why do these people want so much money? I mean, let's say you want everything. You want, like Michael Jackson. You just want to, you know, go into a store and say, I'll take that $1.1 million painting and I'll...
Five of those, three of those.
Yeah. I mean, even if you want to do that, and that's pretty sick behavior, I would say that kind of obsessive acquisitiveness, that why would you, I mean, why wouldn't you, if you had like $80 million, why would you go like, take $70 million and give it to, I don't know what, name your favorite charity. And people then, and they would love her. They would say, wow. I mean, when I, never mind about me.
But get this. Enough about me.
Get this. The order left Ruth Madoff with $2.5 million in assets.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, man, they're really sucking it to her.
What is she going to do?
The agreement stripped the Madoffs of all their interests in properties belonging to them, including homes in Manhattan, Montauk, New York, Palm Beach, Florida, worth a total of $22 million. The Madoffs must also forfeit all insured or saleable personal property contained in the homes.
So where what is she doing these days?
I don't know. Hanging out. She'll be doing, what do they do, charities or something.
Oh, yes, yes.
All right. Here is Skip. Skip's in Detroit. You've been waiting very patiently. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead, Skip.
Yeah, I'm going to college in the area here, and they had a lady come in and talk to the class for 2 hours where she pointed out that your education and your work experience are only 30% of what's important in being qualified for a job.
What's the rest?
How pretty you are and how much you like talking to you at the interview.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's so bad that I asked her to make this clearer to me. She said that, say you're going to be a nurse, and you have a bachelor's degree in nursing. But before that, you got a master's degree in engineering. She said that if you are going for a nursing job, and you write down you have a master's degree in engineering also, yeah, that it will make you look bad because you can't decide on what you want to do in life.
Huh. Well...
Wow.
It's really a buyer's market. In other words, that the people that are doing the employing can be as, you know, as arbitrary as they want because, unfortunately, it is their deal right now.
I think there is some truth to also to what he said about pretty people.
Yeah.
People are shallow, you know.
I had long hair and piercings, so in one day I cut it and took them out, and I suddenly became 50% smarter just in that one day.
Well, I mean, that's
amazing.
The way they viewed you. Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, people have the sense of how you are going to present their enterprise to the world. So there probably is a lot of discrimination against people that aren't perceived as attractive or their weight or, color still. Figures
yes.
In all
gender.
This. Gender, yeah.
You yeah. know.
Sexual preference, if that's
yes.
obvious. I don't know.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, all right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Some open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF, in terms of what Skip just said. Bob Herbert asks in yesterday's New York Times, how do you put together a consumer economy that works when the consumers are out of work? One of the great stories you'll be hearing over the next couple of years will be about the large number of Americans who were forced out of work in this recession and remained unable to find gainful employment after the recession ended. He says we're in basic denial about this. Well, one of the things that is going to happen is that people are going to be rehired, but at much, much less than...
Yeah.
Yeah, because we always thought things were upward and onward.
The bargain staff.
Yeah. There are now more than five unemployed workers for every job opening in the United States.
Mm.
The ranks of the poor are growing, welfare rolls are rising, and young American men on a broad front are falling into an abyss of joblessness.
Wow.
I know a lot of you folks don't want to hear this, but
But a lot of you are in that position.
Yeah. Some months ago, the Obama administration and various mainstream economists forecast a peak unemployment rate of roughly 8% this year. It has already reached 9.4, and most analysts now expect it to hit 10% or higher. It's probably 30% in Detroit proper.
Yeah.
And when you start talking about people that are working at abysmally poor wages, below a living wage, it could be up around 50%. Economists are currently spreading the word that the recession may end sometime this year, but Bob Herbert says the unemployment rate will continue to climb. He says that's not a recovery, that's mumbo jumbo.
Wow.
That's a nice phrase.
Yeah, sure.
Mumbo jumbo.
Got an email from Marty who said he's a great show. He's listening from Scottsdale, Arizona, and he says, Detroit's lucky to have us, Peter,
and
keep up the great work. Thanks for listening, Marty. First-time listener of the show.
And for all of you listening around the country and the world.
Yes.
I mean, thanks to all of you here in the WRF listening area, but hey, we're old friends.
Yes,
but for those of you listening from far away, and what was the person in Scottsdale? What was his name?
Marty.
Oh, it was Marty. Okay. Yeah, Marty, I'm always curious. How do people find out about this show?
Well, we went to high school together.
Oh, this is Marty said hello to.
Yeah.
Okay. All
right. See, you know, and I never know. We're different people than we are in high school, right? You know, there are people that I went to high school with who we were fast friends, and then I find out that they're these raging Republicans. So I never really know. I always kind of warn them. You know, I'm a little bit of a wildcat. And
you kind of went to a rich school, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. I did. And I was a rebel then, and I'm a rebel now.
I went to a Detroit school.
I know.
Yeah, you went? Okay, quit bragging.
Me feel bad.
Along the lines that Bob Herbert was talking about, it's going to be okay for the elite. Wow, what a concept. This article, Citigroup has a plan to fatten salaries. Remember Citigroup? We gave them all that money. We. Remember, I'm always trying to be precise about the pronouns we use. This is very precise because we bailed them out. After all those losses and bailouts, says this article in the Times, rank-and-file employees of Citigroup are getting some good news. Their salaries are going up. Yours may be going down, but if you are in Citigroup, they're going up. Rank and file. The troubled banking giant. Now, wait a minute. What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah.
They're the troubled banking giant. They couldn't make it on their own. The free market. These guys, can you imagine how many Citigroup executives, all these expensively dressed and bankers, all Republicans and conservatives probably, talking about the free market. They couldn't make it on their own. Anyways, they symbolize the troubles in the nation's financial industry. They intend to raise workers' base salaries by as much as 50% this year to offset smaller annual bonuses, according to people with direct knowledge of their plan.
This just baffles me.
Yes. Yeah.
Just shaking my head saying, what?
Yeah. The shift means that most Citigroup employees will make as much money as they did in 2008.
Oh, boy.
Although some might earn more and others less. The company also plans to award millions of new stock options to employees in an effort to retain workers and neutralize a precipitous drop in the value of their stock holdings.
So they're trying to convince us that the bailout works, by rewarding the fat cats with
more. Are you ready for this? I mean,
I don't know.
We need a drum roll. We should have sound effects for this program.
We should.
There is actually good news. Good news. How often do you hear good news on this show? And good news for Michigan. Michigan had a day of good news Friday when two major companies said they'd pick spots in the economically depressed state for their manufacturing facilities. This is from USA Today. General Electric.
GE.
Gee, there you go. Thank you. General Electric. Corporal punishment. You have General Electric, corporal punishment, private parts.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Yeah. They're going to hire 1,100 scientists, engineers, and technologists. What is a technologist? In a new manufacturing technology and software development site in Van Buren Township. And General Motors said they've picked the Orion Township plant for to make the subcompact and compact car.
So good news. Yay.
Now, this is interesting. GM will be the only automaker to produce a subcompact car in the United States. Now, the whole deal was that they made these huge SUVs because they were able to make a big profit, and you can't make a big profit on these small cars.
Mm-hmm.
It says typically production of smaller vehicles has been in low-cost countries because the cars haven't historically brought in much profit for the car companies. Here's the bad news, folks. We're now a low-cost country. Mm-hmm. Remember, the UAW agreed we're going to pay people $14 an hour.
Right.
Yeah. So that's $28,000 a year for working in an auto plant.
Yeah. The conditions.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, the free market, which the bankers don't believe in, means that now we're up against the Mexican workers that are building cars for $2 an hour. Sweet.
Mm.
All right, let's go here. Here's Mike in Rochester. Mike, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
We're good.
Good. The last time I talked to you, I reminded you that Alan Greenspan was married to Andrea Mitchell at NBC.
Oh, yeah.
NBC News.
Yeah. You didn't remind me. You informed me. Go ahead.
Well, and I also wanted to make a statement before I get to my point, that the bankers, where they're made to, they're named to make a profit by the government, okay, like under General Motors and the small car with Orion and Citigroup, that's a fascist form of government. And that's where we're headed. And just take a look at the energy bill, and you'll know what you need. But beyond that, I wanted to make the point that you were talking earlier about the mythology that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
Well, with those weapons of mass destruction that he didn't have, he killed over 100,000 Iranians and Kurds in the Iranian-Iraq war.
Yeah, that he did that, and he was given the okay by the Bush 1 administration and Donald Rumsfeld right after he used poison gas on his own people, as people always use that phrase. The Kurds in the north, Donald Rumsfeld came over there and gave him a gift of golden spurs. He was our boy. Saddam Hussein was George Herbert Walker Bush's man in the Middle East.
And I won't argue with that at all.
Okay.
You're exactly right. That was true. Okay. But the fact of the matter is, mustard gas is by definition a weapon of mass destruction. So he had them and used them.
Yeah, but they got rid of them. They got rid of everything after 1991. They didn't have any of that. It was all made up. No one believes that he had anything like that anymore. Everybody knows it was a lie. And hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have died because of the U.S. the illegal invasion of Iraq. Are we really talking about this again? That George Bush and Rumsfeld and the rest of them, particularly since Cheney, are actually international war criminals. Because they committed the what's known as a crime against peace. They invaded a country with absolutely no justification whatsoever. The United States was in no danger whatsoever. This was all fabricated and based on fear. They planned this long time ago, and you can see the results of it now. The United States Oil Company, guess which one? ExxonMobil is going to be able to go back into Iraq and exploit those oil resources. So it was and is a war for oil, and we ought to get out of there completely immediately. All right, I got to do some commercial. Thank you for that, and we will be right back. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. The future is here.
We do not need to be afraid anymore.
From your iPhone 3G, download the free WRIF app in the iTunes Store. It gives you one-touch access to WRIF streaming live wherever you are. For more details at WRIF.com.
The Riff.
The Riff. The Riff.
The international record labels are asking Congress for a handout, and they want to take it from your local radio stations. That may mean stations like this one have to cut back on the music we play or the community services we provide. Representative Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick and Sandra Levin can help by sponsoring a bill to keep the radio you love free from a performance tax. Call today and ask them to sponsor the Local Radio Freedom Act and oppose a performance tax on free radio. And thank you to Representative Candace Miller for her support of free radio. Learn more at noperformancetax.org. This message furnished by the NAB and this station.
If your credit card debt has gotten out of control, if you're over your head at monthly payments, here's one powerful secret the credit card companies don't want you to know. You have the right to settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, allowing you to cut your debt up to half or more. That's bad news for credit card companies, but it's great news for you. We're Consumer Debt Advocate, and we'd like to offer you a free consultation that will help you start eliminating credit card debt. For your free consultation that will set you free, call 1-800-984-6953. Don't ruin your credit by declaring bankruptcy. Settle your debt and move on with your life. During your free consultation, you'll find out what the credit card companies don't want you to know. For your free consultation that will help you settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, call today. The number is 1-800-984-6953. 1-800-984-6953.
Hey, back to the show in just a sec. But before that, have you guys heard about this? There's this computer program that literally has newcomers to the internet earning tens of thousands of dollars. See, this program lets you start selling high-profit products on the internet using sites like eBay. Selling stuff like digital cameras and iPod accessories, even plasma TVs. Now, here's a part I think's interesting. You can make all this money selling products that you never have to see or store or pay for. And there's a company that's giving out a CD for free that tells you how to get started with it. The number for the free CD is, it's here. It's 1-800-900-8414. Looks like your computer does the work while you basically collect the money. Seems like an easy way to run a business out of your house. Anyway, to get the free CD, you call Internet Speedway at 1-800-900-8414. 1-800-900-8414.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Jalene Jordan is with me. 313-298-WRIF. We'll be taking your calls up until 1 a.m. Eastern Time. And then two interviews, one with Michael Clare about oil, and it's starting to run out. And also Robert Grossman talking about, well, some of these new restrictions that Obama has attempted to place back again on corporations so the same stuff doesn't happen again. That's free markets, Reaganomics, which has sunk us. But the last caller was talking about this climate change bill that went through the House. 44 Democrats voted against it. It just barely squeaked through, 219 to 212. And at the heart of this legislation, and I don't even want to get into this whole cap and trade system, it sets limits on overall emissions. And, I mean, again, if you think, oh, man, let's talk about something exciting. I mean, you know, we're being poisoned by these emissions, and so they're trying to stop this. And also, I mean, it's just our individual health, what global warming, climate change is doing to the whole world, how this could have impact on everything from low-lying areas of our country and the rest of the world up and to whether this planet will continue to be hospitable for us. But Obama hailed the House passage of the bill as a bold and necessary step, and the conservatives, of course, are going crazy because since Obama's for it, they're against it. And also the Chamber of Commerce doesn't like it because it might cost some businesses some money. Although, let me see, the Republicans, what's his name? What's the guy that is the John Boehner, right? The head of the, he actually did a little mini filibuster, which they actually do not have.
You know, we're so juvenile sometimes.
Wasn't
but
that
I
his
guess
name?
That was all me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you could.
What are you going to do?
Where is he in here? Anyway,
you can change your name.
Yeah. The legislation, a patchwork of compromises, falls short of what many European governments and environmentalists have said is needed to avert the worst effects of global warming. Oh, well, you have to compromise. And it pitted liberal Democrats from the East and West Coasts against more conservative Democrats from areas dependent on coal for electricity and on heavy manufacturing for jobs. While some environmentalists enthusiastically supported the legislation, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, opposed it. U.S. Chamber of Commerce, led by John Engler, the ex-governor of Michigan, and the National Association of Manufacturers opposed it. Actually, Dow Chemical, they're still around. They still make napalm? I don't know. And Ford supported it. Republican leaders called the legislation a national energy tax and predicted that it would hurt the Democrats at the polls. Now, they actually estimate, is this in here? Yeah. The bill would grant a majority of permits. So you get these permits to, the big companies do, to pollute. And then they become more and more expensive. And this is supposed to be, in a sense, almost the market, although it's not exactly the market, making these companies figure out, well, you know, it's too expensive to pollute. So, that the Congressional Budget Office estimated the average American household would pay an additional $175 a year in energy costs by 2020 as a result of the provision. You know what? And probably if you poll people, say, would you pay $175 more a year so we're not sucking in poisons from the pollutants that these big manufacturing plants put out and, you know, energy-producing plants, coal plants and all that? And most people would probably say, yeah. I mean, you factor it over a year, what's $175? You know what? I don't want to pay a penny. And, in fact, these companies ought to be paying us more. Part of their profit structure has been based on the fact that they were able to poison us. Because long ago, there should have been legislation that said, you've got about a year and a half to get to the point of zero emissions, mm-hmm. zero toxic emissions. And if you don't, it's going to be confiscated by the government. We will put in the equipment, and you cannot pass this along to your customers or your the people that get the utilities. What's the word? Rate holders? No. Anyway, it's absolutely amazing that they've been able to make a profit by poisoning us, and this has been True. Allowed to go on.
Yes, absolutely.
So the idea that this is some kind of radical bill just shows you how far to the right we are. Okay, let's take some more calls here.
And you don't mean we.
What do you mean we?
You said how right we are. Oh, you mean correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know what the hell I meant. I can't remember what I said. Here's Russ. He's on Parsons Island. Hi, Russ. How's everything up on the island?
Hey, Peter. Hey, Julian. Everything's good. This is a first-time call.
Welcome.
And a long-time listener to you guys.
Well, thanks.
I just got a quick question for you about to relieve the taxes on the cigarettes and, you know, kind of everything.
Yeah.
Is why don't they just legalize
it? Legalize it, man.
Yeah.
Legalize marijuana. Well, you know, it looks like its time has come. I think a lot of those restrictions are going to go away. I mean, think about the millions of people that have suffered as a result of this legislation. I mean, it's one thing, you know, to claim that addictions to things like crack and heroin and all that have a bad effect on people's health. I mean, once it's prohibition, of course, then it, like alcohol prohibition did, the crime comes into it and officials are bought off and all of that. And there's a huge profit for its illegality. And then government agencies, and they hire all these people, and there's all these people sent to prison. So it all works out. Although our average citizen is the victim of these drug policies, because it is he and she, our neighbors, our family, friends, sometimes us, that suffer because of these drug policies. And that so millions of people have had their lives ruined, not by drugs, although some people have had their lives ruined by drugs, to be sure. In order to save a few people that fall victim to addiction, they have harmed the lives of probably tens of millions of people, spent hundreds of billions of dollars on of our public treasury. And again, we could have spent $50 billion on getting safe rail cars, so things like that happen in Washington, D.C. Tennessee didn't occur, or we could have good schools in the rest. Is that what you mean, essentially?
Well, yeah, something like that. Plus, you know, for like people who know about drugs, it's just education. I mean, it's not for everybody, you know. It's like alcohol is not for everybody.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I know that, I mean, I shouldn't have more than 6 or 7 drinks a day, so
what?
I'm only kidding.
You would be on the floor.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, I'm not much of a drinker myself, you know, and I'm the same way, 6 beers, and I'm, you know, pretty much done. But, you know, I just...
I can barely drive after I've had 6 beers.
Oh, Peter. Terrible.
No, that's true. I'm very aware of that. I would say I actually had 3 drinks in a day. That I can't remember the
last.
You
did?
I had a beer for lunch. I had a gin and tonic before dinner. And we went down to those festivals I was telling you about earlier around Wayne State University, and I had another beer. So,
see,
man.
The great news is your wife doesn't drink, so you have a designated driver.
Yeah, I do indeed. Yeah. All right, Russ, glad to hear from you up on Parsons Island. Here is Andy's in Redford. Hi, Andy. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to get involved. Man, I wish I could talk to you for about 2 hours, you two, because you hit so many subjects. It's so exciting. You get me so riled up.
We're good.
But I'm going to try to control whatever I'm going to tell you. But let me start from the middle, and that is I took breathalyzer training for the Metro Police Force here in southeastern Detroit. And I want to tell you a story about the 2 out of the 50 of us that were taking this classroom class. It was a couple of day training course to operate the breathalyzer right here in the Tri-County area. And they had a couple of us volunteer to drink to see what the effects of alcohol were like. And I'm not a drinker,
okay,
which means I'm a something-elser.
Right.
So I think we ought to legalize it. But
wait. You're not a police officer.
Retired.
Okay. All right.
So I live my life doing the right thing, but, you know, it's after work.
Okay.
You come home and relax, and, you know, you're all right. But I volunteered. I'm not a drinker. I volunteered, and I ended up consuming 5 shots of Seagram's.
Wow.
And did not break the legal limit.
Oh, come on.
Here in Michigan, and I was blasted.
Wow.
How could you have 5 shots and not, I mean, I'd be worried about having 2. You'd go over the limit.
Not go over the limit? I don't know. I had 5 exactly to the line shots of Seagram's with another guy in the back of the class. And, of course, it's funny how you unwind. We started getting giggly and goosey, and we were starting to make jokes, and our faces were getting red, and we were looking at each other. I had a best friend suddenly. The other 48 guys are laughing at us, and the instructor was getting a big charge out of how goofy we'd become. And I was surprised I didn't heave, and I also was surprised at how low I blew. Maybe we blew too early, and it didn't get into our systems enough. But I do not drink. I'm a 1 beer, 2 beer, that's it, social. I took a 5. I was young. I was 21 at the time. And we just got so loose and goofy, and I could see myself coming undone, but I thought I was pretty hysterical at the time, and I was stunned that I didn't blow over, which makes me think how many times somebody is so drunk, and it's not about blowing over. It's about your conduct and responsibility. But let me hurl way ahead and just say, between answering most of the questions, like almost biblically, you can say that it seems like the root of all of our problems are either hypocrisy or greed. But I want to ask
you. There you go.
That.
Yeah. At least we'd be ahead of the game if we ended those.
I want to ask you two, especially the big guy, how are we ever going to get anywhere other than out of the trouble we're in if we continue, not continue, but we've spent more than, I can't believe what we've spent, and is it just going to be the paper mill running? They're just going to keep printing? How are we ever going to afford what we're doing? Entitlements have taken over. We spend money we don't have. It's just out of control. In fact, I haven't been able to talk to you guys in a while, but you had a question a while back. What would we go protest for downtown if we could protest one thing? This might have been a couple months back.
Yeah.
What would be the one thing to protest? And I thought it would be spending money we don't have.
Well, you know, most of us do, if you think within reason. I mean, the problem is, and I don't know where the cutoff line is, Andy, that good sections of the American people are in debt. Most of us at least owe tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands even on our houses, so we're in debt there. I mean, people live on credit and the credit card and what have you. And most economists on the left and the right agree agree that a national debt is not the worst thing in the world. If you start, for instance, though, get to the point where the currency becomes the value of the currency becomes eroded, there could be an enormous crash, because part of it is just sort of some spooky kind of trust or belief that things are going to continue to or let me put it this way, that they're not going to fall apart. And I've seen enough of people saying that what's happening with the spending of the stimulus bill, that this will eventually come around. I mean, look at some of these banks have already repaid their TARP loans, and I mean, I'm not even supporting this or defending it or saying that that's correct. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. I could, like I think you're suggesting, create the scariest scenario imaginable, the worst case scenario, and sometimes worst case scenarios do in fact come true. And this does look like, many ways, the whole economy, even before this even collapsed. I mean, I was always saying that it was a house of cards. It's all kind of a Ponzi scheme, a pyramid scheme, where real value, most everything is overvalued, and real value ain't there. And if you told everybody that let's say there's a couple, I don't know, $7 trillion worth of worth in this country or value. You said, bring it all and put it on the table. I mean, people couldn't bring 2 or 3% of it. And when we talk about this, I always say, my check is direct deposited. I charge almost everything, so I get air miles. Then I write a check to the credit card company. And once in a while, I have a few 20s in my pocket. So where's the real money? I mean, mostly people, talked about these gold sovereigns in their pantaloons and all that. That's kind of gone by the wayside. So, all right, thank you very much, Andy. I don't know what's going to happen. But, they got this clunkers, cash for clunkers program that they passed.
I saw something about that, but I don't really know the details.
Well, interestingly, in Europe, there were hundreds of thousands of car owners that had taken advantage of these government subsidies to get rid of old vehicles, trade up to new ones. Car sales in Germany are actually up 40%.
Really?
Yeah, because of these things. But a similar, this is out of the New York Times, similar so-called cash for clunkers program that starts in July in the United States is not expected to have nearly the same impact. While the program, which President Obama signed into law this week, gives consumers a credit that is in line with the payments in Europe, up to $4,500, what qualifies as a clunker in the United States is far more limited. Also, it's $1 billion in financing, enough for about 250,000. And consumers in Europe, or I'm sorry, in Germany. In Germany, it's they have 1.5 billion euros, which is, maybe not twice as much, but more. It's enough to get 600,000 old cars off the road, and they're raising the budget to 5 billion euros for 2 million cars and extending the deadline. Now, there's a whole series on which I'm not going to bother to read of what it takes, but it's not like everybody's saying, hey, yeah, man, I'm going to go in and get $4,500 for this. I mean,
I don't get, how does it work? Explain this, like Cliff Notes, maybe.
I don't even know if I can do the Cliff Notes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty complicated.
Yeah, that's why I'm a little confused.
The rules mean that the owner of a 2003 Chevrolet Trailblazer, which qualifies because it gets about 16 miles per gallon, would get $2,000 less under the program than by making a normal trade-in. Huh? Conversely, a 92 Honda Civic, which is worth only a few hundred dollars, does not qualify because its gas mileage is too high. It's not easy. But it's out there. Let's talk to Lars. He's in Madison Heights. Lars, thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hi, Peter. I actually wanted to respond to the gentleman who called earlier about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And the ironic thing is that something that Sean Hannity actually railed on, that they actually found a bunch of mustard and sarin and I think even some anthrax warheads in Iraq, but they were all prior to the first Gulf War, and sarin and mustard have a shelf life of approximately 6 months.
Isn't this what we gave them, though?
Well, I know we gave them anthrax, but it was supposedly...
Wait, let's watch our pronouns here. I didn't give a damn thing.
Right.
Yeah, the United States government and also other governments.
It was Reagan who gave them weapons. George Bush was the one who was in charge during the first Gulf War.
Right.
Right.
And you had said it was George Herbert Walker Bush?
Yeah.
Reagan gave him.
Yeah, it was Reagan.
I'm sorry. During that period, that's right, it was during the administration of Reagan that that Rumsfeld went over there and gave Saddam Hussein a gift of golden spurs. That's right.
Yeah, well,
thank you for the correction. The correction department is always open.
Yes, and there's some other like weird ironies to like the justification for Iraq. Like there actually was a terrorist who said that he was trained by Saddam Hussein to use chemical weapons, but he'd been, just basically been tortured and interrogated for so many days. He just told them what they thought they wanted to hear, and Colin Powell actually took that to...
Well, that's why that was part of the torture program.
Yes, and also they talk about the terrorist training camps in Iraq. They were actually in Kurdistan and being operated by Ansar al-Islam to overthrow Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, they were.
And were used that as proof of his connections to terrorism when they themselves are, you know, maybe the equivalent of MySpace friends to al-Qaeda with no real connections, just superficial niceties.
Yeah. Well, it was all a lie, and there's hundreds of thousands of people died, and we don't even... how many people know how many GIs died this week in Iraq or Afghanistan? You know what, Lars, and I know you were in Iraq, that every week I've updated on my site how many people have died in each theater, and I forgot about it today. So someone's son or daughter, someone's husband, mm-hmm. or some relative or friend or neighbor died in Iraq because of George W. Bush's lies, and it quote slipped my mind, and I suspect it probably slipped most other people's minds as well. Yeah.
Lars. Oh, he's gone.
Lars is gone. Okay, we're almost out of time. Anyway. Never mind. let me see. Do we have time for this? We got a minute or so. This new border fear, violence by a rogue militia. I mean, what kind of militia isn't a rogue militia that's not part of the United States
right.
government or state government? You know, there was all these warnings about right-wing domestic terrorism, and these conservatives all went crazy. And then, you know, they've been assassinating people and... you know, killing cops and, you know, all these.
The museum.
Yeah, the museum, this guy that killed police officers in Pittsburgh. They're all influenced by these right-wing commentators. They all, you know, they sure don't listen to me. They go, oh, yeah, listen to Werby. I'm going to go shoot somebody. They listen to, Hannity or Rush Limbaugh or, yeah, Fox News. And they go out and, I mean, most people don't. I mean, I would say the overwhelming majority of Fox Noise does not shoot people. I'll give them that.
Right. Yeah. It's just kind of like this.
Yeah.
Duh.
Yeah. But here, this is a quote. This is in Arivaca, Arizona. Somebody just came in and shot my daughter and my husband, the woman shouted to the 911 dispatcher. They're coming back in. They're coming back in. Multiple gunshots are then heard on a tape of the call. The woman, Gina Gonzalez, survived the attack after arming herself with her husband's handgun, but both he and their 10-year-old daughter died. The killings last month have terrified the small town near the Mexican border, in part because the authorities have now tied them to what they describe as a rogue group engaged in citizen border patrols. You know, these nutballs that think that, like there was this guy talking about them, they're always thinking, oh, you know, the immigrants are going to overwhelm us, right?
Yeah.
Well, now that there's no job, so they're leaving. The three people arrested in the crime include the leader of Minutemen American Defense, a Washington state-based offshoot of the Minutemen movement in which citizens roam the border looking for people crossing into the country illegally.
They're still at it, huh?
Yeah. Former members describe the group's leader, Shauna Ford, as having anti-immigrant sentiments that are extreme, at times frightening, even to people accustomed to hardline views on border policing.
That's so shocking.
Yeah, so they figured out that they could they would rip off drug dealers, except these people that they killed weren't drug dealers. So they're in jail, but Merrill Metzer, who worked for the group for 6 months when it was getting started, he Ford woman presented a plan plan for the group to undertake. And he says she was sitting here talking about how she was going to start an underground militia and rob drug dealers. Metzger quit the group, alarmed, he said, by a number of things, including Ms. Ford's demand for extreme loyalty right down to the choice of cuisine. He said, I had to take an oath, and part of the oath was that I couldn't eat Mexican food.
This is just...
These people are so sick, and they're among us.
They're wacko.
They are wacko. That's when the red flags went up all over for me. That seemed like prejudice.
Oh,
hello.
Just a little teeny weeny bit.
All right, dear listeners, that's it for the phone and talk section of this. We are now going to go to the recorded interviews, previously recorded with two very interesting guests. And I'm saying it in this tone because we've been having immense problems.
Issues.
I am starting two fresh, brand new interviews that have never been heard before. There should not be an interview with an author of a biography of the great pitcher Satchel Paige.
If so, please write.
Don't call, because I'm going home.
Yeah, that's right.
But I'm looking. It is impossible, it would seem, for anything to air other than these. All right. Jolene Jordan, thank you so much. Roger, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
And thank you for listening and calling.
Oh, yes, man.
We might not be doing this next week.
Really?
4th of July,
Sunday.
Oh, that's
Sunday. True.
I wrote Doug. He hasn't written back.
To be announced.
I would say we were not going to be here next week.
I'm thinking, but, you know.
Check my website, peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com.
I'd rather be here than not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We only work once a week. What the hell? Are we on the air? Oh, yeah. All right. Will we be for long? Talk next week or the week after.
Okay.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on your iPhone 3G. We hope you'll take a brief survey about how you use your iPhone at WRIF.com/iPhone. And thanks for listening to The Riff Worldwide at WRIF.com.
I looked at her, and I was just, wow, she looked so young.
I told her I couldn't believe how smooth her face looks. She's lost, what, 10 years at least?
I look at her, and it's like I'm looking at a picture of my wife from 20 years ago. It's incredible.
How are ordinary women across America looking years younger? They've discovered the proven breakthrough called Hydroxytone. It erases wrinkles, tightens skin, and makes frown lines disappear from view. See for yourself by requesting a free trial of Hydroxytone today. The results are so impressive. Hydroxytone was given away in VIP gift bags at international film festivals. Try Hydroxytone risk-free and shed years from your appearance faster than you thought possible.
She always looked good to me, but now I can't believe how young she looks.
Call now for your free trial of Hydroxytone. For a limited time, try it before you buy it. 1-800-630-3327. But hurry, when this offer's gone, it's gone. Call 1-800-630-3327. 1-800-630-3327.
The raw power of a Harley-Davidson could be yours. Motor City Harley-Davidson's Harley Fest 2009. Presented by 101, WRIF, and Miller Lite. Win a sweet 2009 Harley-Davidson XL 1200 Nightster. Courtesy of Motor City Harley-Davidson. Get on the list to win a key to these sweet wheels. July 11th at Hill Creek Ranch. Plus, details on how you can win a key in person. Feel the rush. Harley Fest 2009. Presented by Motor City Harley-Davidson. Feel the freedom of the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. Also from Miller Lite. Taste greatness. And your Harley Fest station, 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. You know, there's so many things in our daily life we take for granted. We take it for granted when we turn on a light, it's going to go on. We take it for granted that we're going to go down to the gas station and get some gasoline, even though it's sort of edging up a bit these days. Energy is what makes the modern world go around. That's almost a cliche. And problems revolving around energy and access access to it is everything from politics to war. And one of the people that we've been in contact with over the years, has been on this program any number of times, is Michael T. Clare. He's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He's the author, most recently, of Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. It's published by Henry Holt, and we interviewed him when it appeared. A DVD of the documentary film based on his previous book, Blood and Oil, is also available. His most recent essay is Michael Clare, Goodbye to Cheap Oil. It's a Tom Graham. You can go to tomdispatch.com. Actually, the name of the piece is Goodbye to Cheap Oil. And we reach Michael Clare in his office in Amherst, Massachusetts. Welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, I just I knew I was doing this interview with you, so I was looking at the pumps as I drove here to work, and it actually seems like they're down a little, so it's up a little, down a little, sort of like the weather. You know, we watch it go up and down. What are the elements that that create this seemingly uncontrollable rise and drop in prices?
You know, you begin with the basic product itself, crude petroleum, and what the cost of that is, and that too goes up and down, and then you add in the refining costs and the demand side of the equation. Now, we've seen a lot of gyrations in both the cost of the crude petroleum and in demand. We've seen record highs a year ago about this time. The price of crude petroleum went as high as $170 a barrel. Now it's down to about $65-$70 a barrel, so there's been a big collapse in the prices, but we've seen it as low as $35 a barrel, so it's gone up from there. And I think we're in for a period in which the price of crude petroleum will probably edge upwards. It will probably not go as high as we saw it a year ago, but I don't think it will drop back down to $35 a barrel either. So I think we're going to see a long-term edging upwards as the economies of the world improve slowly. And as the economies of the world improve, we'll see demand for petroleum increase, and that will lead to slowly edging upwards prices.
Let me correctly give people the name of your essay. That's at tomdispatch.com. Here I'm reading it, and I finally got down to what it really is. Energy Department changes tune on peak oil. Now, this seems like sort of obscure data contained in the Energy Information Administration of the U.S. Department of Energy when it issues its International Energy Outlook. I think it takes someone who's committed to figuring this all out, like yourself, to really get into this. But what are the essentials there that affect the average person that wants to drive to work and not have to pay $50 to fill up their tank?
Well, this is the big story, I think, the outlying story, meaning how things are going to develop over the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, looking into the future. And the Department of Energy has a information analysis arm called the Energy Information Administration, or EIA. And every year, the EIA publishes a set of statistics giving their predictions for the future availability and cost of oil, called the International Energy Outlook. And I've been studying these meticulously for the past 10 years or so and looking at how they see the future of oil. And up until a year or so ago, they were extremely optimistic about the future availability of oil. And this reflected the industry-wide view that oil is going to be plentiful and relatively affordable, looking, you know, far into the future, 10, 20, 30, 40 years into the future, that there'll be a steady increase in the availability of supply, there'll be a lot of oil, and therefore it'll be relatively affordable. Now, there have been a growing number of oil experts who questioned this highly optimistic view. And a lot of these skeptics are associated with what's called the peak oil movement, claiming that we're about to come up on a peak, a summit in the world availability of oil, and that then the supply will begin to decline. And up until now, the Department of Energy has said, no. The global supply of oil will keep growing indefinitely. This year, for the first time, you begin to see real pessimism in the Department of Energy's reports, predictions on future availability of oil. They've really ratcheted down their projections for future oil. Their predictions this year for the amount of oil that'll be available in 20 years, in 2030, is 20 million barrels a day less than it was just 2 years ago. And they seem to be coming much closer to the views of the peak oil theorists who say we're about to reach the peak in the availability of oil and start going into decline.
I was going to say, let me just interrupt to say, when we talk about peak oil, it doesn't mean we're going to run out like in now or in 2030 or anything like that, but we've essentially taken about half of what is available, and the ability to extract it in the manner that we have previously is makes it less available. Is that a fair summation?
Yes, it means that the ability of the oil industry to put more out on the market next year than this year and more each succeeding year into the future will disappear. That each year in the future there will be about the same amount of oil as there is now or even less is more likely to be the case. And considering that we know that demand for oil is going to rise because of China's insatiable demand, that tells us that the prices are going to rise. When you have more and more demand chasing a stagnant supply of oil or a slightly rising supply of oil, you know that prices are going to rise.
Well, is there a free market? I know when we're talking about OPEC, that almost sounds like a ridiculous question, but normally the model of economics is supply and demand. If there's a limited supply and a great demand, price goes up. If it's the reverse, it goes down. And yet the supply certainly can be manipulated and is. Is that correct?
You can manipulate the supply if you are able to pump more oil out of the ground. And that has been the case up until now. Countries like Saudi Arabia were able to up or down their production of oil in response to signals from the market. When demand rose, they were able to increase their output. When demand fell and prices were lowered, they could ramp down their production. In fact, they have been ramping down production in the past few months in response to the global economic crisis. What we're finding today, which makes this a unique moment in the history of the oil age, is the capacity of the major oil producers to ramp up has disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we're in a period in world history where it appears that the oil industry is no longer capable of significantly growing the world supply of oil. This is a turning point, a historic turning point. Now, as you said earlier, Peter, it doesn't mean we're running out of oil. I'm not saying that. What it means is that each year the ability of the oil industry to produce more oil What it means is that each year we're running out of oil from existing fields. In the past, the amount of oil that we could produce from new fields exceeded the amount that disappeared from older fields. That's no longer the case. We're using up older fields more and more rapidly, and we're not discovering new oil, so we cannot increase the world supply anymore.
Well, are we facing a situation, and this was a debate of last year, I don't know why it still isn't, are we being gouged by the major oil companies? ExxonMobil, like, for instance, would have the highest profit levels in their history. If the price of crude went up and they had to raise the price of their cost and sales, you would think that they would make the same amount. But the fact that they made extraordinary profits means that they were charging exorbitant rates way beyond the cost increases that they faced.
Well, the fact is that Exxon Mobil and Chevron and these private oil companies, also known as international oil companies, IOCs, no longer control most of the world's oil. Basically, they refine and market oil acquired from the state-owned oil companies in the Middle East, in Latin America, in the former Soviet Union, and in Africa. 80% of the world's oil is owned by these national oil companies, NOCs, and they are not increasing the supply. So if Exxon and Chevron could increase their output, they would do so. They are not capable any longer of increasing supply.
No, I hear that, but why would they be making increased profits? You know what I'm saying? If their costs go up, they should be making the same level of profits unless they decided to raise the price above what it would...
Because they are making more profits because the global cost of petroleum is rising everywhere, and when the price goes up everywhere, what they sell goes up as well.
So do you say we're not being gouged, or are we? By when ExxonMobil has these extraordinary profits.
Oh, well, I think that there are a lot of speculators in the market who have bid up the price of oil, and certainly there's a lot of price inflation that has taken place, and the oil companies are certainly benefiting from that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the root of all of this is a imbalance between supply and demand, which the oil companies are the beneficiaries of.
Michael Clare is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. His most recent book is Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, the New Geopolitics of Energy. That may be a phrase that everybody in the audience doesn't understand. What exactly is the geopolitics of energy, and what's new about them?
Very good. Well, I use geopolitics to talk about the politicization or the militarization of the global struggle over oil. And this begins with the fact that oil is different from other commodities. Oil is viewed as a strategic commodity by the major oil importing countries like the United States and China. We view oil differently than other commodities like fruits and vegetables and even iron ore and copper, which is to say we view oil as so vital to our economy that we say it's a national security matter, and we're willing to go to war if necessary to protect the flow of oil. That is U.S. established U.S. policy. It's embedded in the Carter Doctrine of 1980, which says that the flow of Middle Eastern oil to the United States is a vital national security interest, and if anybody threatens that flow, we'll use any means necessary to protect the flow, including the use of military force. And that's the basis on which the U.S. went to war in 1990 against Iraq when it invaded Kuwait and on other occasions. So oil is viewed differently. It's a strategic commodity. And now that the supply, the world supply of oil appears to be diminishing in relationship to demand, more and more countries are in struggle and intense competition for what's left, especially the United States and China, but also Europe, Japan, India, and other countries, and they're all using military means to stake out control over what's left. in Africa, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, and this takes military form. So it's this militarization of the struggle for oil that I call the new geopolitics of energy.
A lot of what we're talking about is contained in Michael Clare's latest article at tomdispatch.com. It's called Energy Department Changes Tune on Peak Oil. We've talked a little about this. You bring up the subject of unconventional fuels, that if we're running out of liquid oil in the ground, we could, the suggestion is that we could replace that with oil sands, ultra-deep oil, shale oil, biofuels, and we're making the switch, new fuels. Will this work out to replace what we may not have access to any longer?
I think increasingly you're going to hear a lot about these unconventional fuels as the supply of conventional oil begins to dwindle. So there's a lot of interest, for example, in Canadian tar sands and in the new ultra-deep oil found off of Brazil, as you say, Peter. But there are problems with these unconventional fuels. They entail great environmental risks. Like the Canadian tar sands, it require a great risk to the water supply in Canada. It involves tearing down a lot of trees. It involves using energy to produce the tar sand, so you're not getting a lot of energy out of it, and it produces a lot of carbon dioxide in the process. So the more we move in this direction, the greater the environmental risk that's involved, because by definition these unconventional fuels are less desirable. They're dirtier fuels.
What about the idea that we should be moving in totally towards what we call alternative energy, not unconventional fuels, but solar power and any number of other alternative wind power, water power even in some areas could go back to that? I mean, one of the things that I heard a criticism is most of these companies have too narrow a focus, like an automobile company rather than should have a long time ago called themselves a transportation company, or the railroad. That was it. They said the railroad company should have considered themselves a transportation company, and they could have had railroads, cars, planes, you know, what have you. Same thing here, energy corporation instead of an oil company. So, and some of them are interested, but we could have ExxonMobil making solar panels, for instance. Is there the capacity for alternative energy to fuel modern industrial society?
Well, yes, indeed, Peter, and I think that's the right question to ask, because I think we are entering an era in which you'll see intense competition between differing means of transportation and producing energy. And I think these unconventional fuels represent perhaps the least attractive, because those fuels are a form of hydrocarbons, of oil and petroleum and natural gas, and they represent an effort by the oil companies to cling to their core business rather than to diversify into cleaner, greener alternatives like solar and wind and new generations of ethanol, for example. Your listeners might be interested that the current issue of Scientific American magazine has a cover story on what's called grassoline.
Huh.
That is a fuel based on using grass and other biomass, not food products, but new advanced forms of ethanol that could be made from biomass grown on fields that are not in competition with food products. That would be a more attractive alternative that the energy company should be investing in rather than these dirtier type of unconventional fuels. And
sure,
like you say, the automobile companies could be investing in other modes of transportation. take a look at this horrible accident that occurred in Washington D.C. on the metro,
sure,
where it appears that they were using obsolete rail cars that didn't pass muster for safety. They could be building more advanced rail cars, for example.
You know, I was going to say that U.S. environmentalists, particularly, talk about mass transit. Yet on the other hand, China and India have suddenly these affordable cars that could wind up to have millions and millions of more cars on the planet, which certainly the planet doesn't need, but it's become an expectation of modern industrial society. It's going to be a challenge. I'm looking at the clock, Michael Clare, and I did want to get into one other aspect of our conversation. And Michael Clare has written, Energy Department Changes Tune on Peak Oil. It's available at TomDispatch.com. And that has a bit, and we've talked about some of it, even a bit of a technical ring to it. What doesn't is Michael Clare's previous book, Blood and Oil. And that's what's the most frightening. Very frequently, empires have clashed over resources and wealth and colonies. Is this on the agenda? I somehow can't imagine China and the United States going to war over Middle East oil, or am I being naive?
Well, I think there is a risk of that, Peter, because indeed the U.S. and China are providing arms and military assistance and even military personnel to competing regimes in Africa and in the Middle East and in Central Asia. And this is how wars begin. This is not intentional, not intentional onset of warfare, but what I call inadvertent escalation, unintentional fighting. But when you back opposite sides in a regional conflict in the pursuit of energy, and these things get out of hand, and we've seen that happen before. That's how World War One began, and we are very much involved in that kind of preliminary activity. As I say, in Africa, where the U.S. and China are pouring arms into the various oil regimes in that area.
Well, we think back to the Cold War era. This is the United States and the Soviet Union often fought wars through proxy, yet never came didn't come to a direct confrontation. So, I guess the example I said, I can't imagine frontal warfare with the United States Army fighting the Chinese Army in Iraq or Iran or someplace like that. So big confrontations, hopefully, that's a thing of the past.
I think we should not be so sure that that can happen again. Again, I'm not saying that this would happen intentionally, but as a result of accident. I mean, for example, we've had a number of clashes in the past 10 years between U.S. and Chinese aircraft and warships.
Right.
There was such an incident just a few months ago in the South China Sea between an American warship and Chinese warships. So imagine if at some point down the road where the competition over oil became much more dangerous, much more intense, and there was a lot of suspicion and relations was more poisonous than they are today, and you had an incident like that, and somebody lost their nerve and shots were fired. There were no shots fired in that naval incident, but it was tense for a while. What if shots had been fired? What if communications broke down? I don't think it's impossible that a scenario like that wouldn't lead to fighting. As long as we are committed to the use of force to protect oil and to secure oil, that danger will exist.
I was going to ask you a question, but I guess I'm going to have to end it just with a statement because we're completely out of time. And that is that energy activism around the issue of how energy is supplied and whether we're going to keep on a track where we are devoted to energy that ultimately can bring us to war, certainly to pollution and high costs, energy energy activism is the way to go. This is all summed up in many ways in Michael Clare's article at tomdispatch.com. It's called Energy Department Changes Tune on Peak Oil. I will have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Also, look for Michael Clare's book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. It's published by Henry Holt. I'll have a link to that as well. Michael Clare, as usual, thank you for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Peter, it was great talking with you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
The pictures,
the podcast,
the vlogs,
the special features you just can't get
anywhere else. Get them online at WRIF.com.
I salute yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Well, if you read the news, things are looking up for the economy. In fact, the recession could be over. If you look at some indicators, financial institutions are repaying their TARP funds that we, the taxpayers, loan them. Citigroup just announced that it's raising the pay for its top employees. And Barack Obama is looking at the regulations that failed so badly, the Reaganomics, the free market. Kind of a rude word there. What can we call it? The free market illusion has led to many ways to what we're experiencing now, and Barack Obama is there. Tough new regulations, or are they? We're going to talk with Richard Grossman, and Richard Grossman was last on the Peter Werbe Show with his book, Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy, and that was 8 years ago. He also wrote in 1982, Fear at Work, Job Blackmail, Labor, and the Environment, and the best-selling pamphlet, Taking Care of Business, Citizenship, and the Charter of Incorporation. We'll talk about that as well. He joins us from his home, the Catskill Mountains in New York. Richard Grossman, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks, Peter. I'm glad to be here.
So I don't know where to start. Is the recession over?
Well, what do you think? What do most people think?
In Detroit?
In Detroit, even particularly in the Catskill Mountains here, no, the recession is not over. I'm thrilled, of course, that Citigroup management is contemplating raising the salaries of Citigroup people. That's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, well, is it? They talk about them as being retention bonuses. That it's not that they want to disproportionately reward people, particularly the people responsible for the mess and the people that were. The corporation that was involved in some of the big bailouts, but rather they have to do this in order to keep the top talent. How do you react to that?
That world is so alien for me, Peter, that I can't fathom their thinking. And I mean, pretty much everything that they say or think is alien to me and defies logic. And it's about power. It's not about logic. It's about power. When you're in control, you pretty much do what you want. And the men and women running these corporations have one thing they've gotten better about. Is they're much better in their rhetoric and their language. They know how to try to say things that don't sound so insane or outrageous or dictatorial or tyrannical. But it's, you know, if they didn't have the kind of power that they had, that they have now, and have had, you know, for the last 100+ years, most people would be laughing at what they say.
Why, Richard Grossman, do you put it at 100 years? What changed 100 years?
Well, my sense is that by 1900, by the beginning of the 20th century, the emerging corporate class had pretty much consolidated its grip over government, over at the federal level and at the state and local level, over the continent. What I see is a morphing of what had been from the nation's founding until the Civil War, the slave state and the slave masters north and south and the financiers of the slave state, they were in control. that was broken up by the Civil War to a large extent, and the sort of the corporate robber barons started merging after the war, during the war, and after the war, and started building up their strength and power. And what they accomplished by the beginning of the 20th century was they had fundamentally reconstructed the law and the culture to their liking, to what they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, ever since, this has been what I would call a corporate state, running a corporate system just like we'd had a slave system prior. It's, you know, occasionally more disguised than it is obvious, but, you know, when I read, I saw in the paper the other day that Senator Durbin from Illinois, who was a Democrat trying to get some measure through his through the Congress that would enable judges to be more empathic with people losing their homes, to play around with the mortgage rates and stuff. He got creamed by Wall Street lobbyists, and so he said, "Well, Wall Street owns this Congress." So,
and that wasn't supposed to happen. Barack Obama told us goodbye to lobbyists.
Well, that's all, you know, that's funny because if that's the when Obama describes the problem that led to the financial meltdown, as he did just last Saturday in his radio address, I happened to be listening to that. He said it was a breakdown in oversight.
Mm-hmm.
Well. And then you have Dick Durbin saying, well, Wall Street owns the Congress. Well, which one of those things do you want to fix? I think it's a lot easier for the president to say that he's trying to fix the breakdown in oversight than for anybody to attempt to fix that Wall Street owns the Congress, because then you'd have to say, well, what else do they own? You know, they own an awful lot in the government. So, but that's off the agenda. I mean, the remedy, if Wall Street lobbyists are dominating the Congress, then there is an obvious remedy to that, Peter, and that is strip corporations of any privilege of lobbying.
Yeah, but we can't do that. I mean, that was decided, I think you indicate here in some of the, you're quoted in the Institute for Public Accuracy, that if we go back to the late 1880s, as the Supreme Court held, that corporations have all the right of personage, and to take away their ability to lobby would be a First Amendment violation.
Well, I think that's you put your finger on the pulse here, on the heartbeat, because all it is a Supreme Court decision, and yet then multiple decisions subsequent to that affirming it and expanding it to all different parts of the Constitution. But that's only a Supreme Court. Those are only Supreme Court decisions. You know, one branch of government. You know, nine people laying this out. What that has accomplished is to take off the agenda, take from the agenda the logical things that we should be all talking about today. I mean, of which getting corporations out of our legislative bodies is simply just one. So what I'm suggesting, I mean, by my work over the last 25 years or so has brought me to the point where so much of what we need to do, we as the rabble, as the self-governing people, as the sovereign people, the people who are most hurt by all these, what these corporation leaders are doing and what most government leaders are doing, what we need to do is not even on the agenda, and that we have no remedy under law, you know, because if I were to say or even if Senator Durbin's constituents were to say to him, okay, if you say that Wall Street owns the Congress, then why doesn't Congress act? You are the Congress of the United States. Why don't you act to deal with that? He said, well, I can't do it because of the Supreme Court. It really pulls the rug out from under people and organizing and activism all around the country. And I think that's a parable for our time, that most of the work that people and groups have been doing for so many decades, you know, valiant, persistent, courageous work, you know, from educating and organizing and marching and civil disobedience and you know, all kinds of creative and valiant protests, has essentially not accomplished what people set out to accomplish. And yet when, you know, when we try to sit down and talk about what to do, because so much of that, of what we have to do is considered off the agenda, is considered untouchable, is considered, you know, constitutional issues, blah, blah, blah. We're left with a very small realm of stuff that we actually do, which is the same stuff we've been doing, which hasn't been accomplishing what we wanted to accomplish.
A little bit of wheel spinning. But Richard Grossman, if someone's listening and they would say, well, wait a minute, why is this guy so anti-corporate? Sure, they've, you know, that they've sort of broken off the leash and what have you, but corporations are the lifeblood of the capitalist system. They provide jobs for so many of us. I work for a corporation, and well, you know, we need a few more regulations. And why this sort of deep-seated, at least sounding, anti-corporate perspective that you're putting out?
Actually, Peter, I've evolved, and I don't feel, it's nothing personal about corporations. I'm actually pretty far more, in your language, anti-constitutional than I am anti-corporate, because I think that the Constitution of the United States, as it was written, as it's been implemented and developed, is the essential barrier to we the people actually governing ourselves. The corporation, the business, financial, pretty much all corporations, including the giant educational corporations, colleges and universities, are, as you suggest, they're the main vehicle for providing, you know, goods and services in this country. And they're wrapped, the institutions that are wrapped most in constitutional power and privilege. And what they do is essentially, you know, under sort of the law and the culture, is regarded as private, is regarded as beyond the authority of the American people. So that particularly, you know, business, industrial, financial corporations, what they do is what fundamentally shapes our communities, defines people's work, defines what kinds of goods are produced, how they're produced, what kind of poisons are produced, how much poisons are produced, how much destruction to communities and the earth take place. You know, what's happened to, say, to Detroit over the last 20 years, to Michigan, you know, more recently, what's happened to, you know, many places around the country is the result of in good times, corporate whim, and harder times, the accumulation of decision-making that the corporations had been involved in. So, yes, they're the primary vehicle, but essentially it's considered all, you know, mostly private. And the best that we can do as the sovereign people is maybe regulate them around the edges, you know, regulate their excesses, make sure their excesses don't get too great. And when they get too great, you know, they suffer, we bail them out. We give them our money. I mean, that's sort of been the pattern now in this country for so long. So, for me, we've gotten to a point where we have these private, so-called private entities that are making the real decisions that shape our society, that determine the nature of the planet, the future of our communities, determine to a large extent war and peace, and yet they're beyond our reach, and yet we're supposed to be the sovereign, self-governing people. So how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to address that?
Well, that is difficult. One of the ways it was dealt with originally was, I mean, if you look now when conservatives talk about activist judges and activist courts, the decision in the late 1880s, which gave corporations personhood, so that all the rights that accrue to you as an individual or me, also a corporation would enjoy as well. So when you had a situation where, like in Wisconsin, I think in other states as well, corporations were forbidden to try to influence legislation. And that's one of the right, so-called, one of the rights that they got. So as you said earlier, Richard Grossman, that that it was a small one branch of government, the nine men. I mean, certainly most of the big changes in this country have come about because of mass movements involving substantial numbers of people that wanted to end slavery or get women the vote or stop wars or unionize or what have you. So it seems to me that if things are going wrong here, it's we the people that are letting it happen.
Well, but I think we the people have been sold a bill of goods on one level regarding our history, regarding how government works. You know, I think the assumptions that so many people make when they say, oh, there's a problem, I'll form an organization and we'll educate people and we'll set out to solve the problem. the assumption is that law is on our side, that the mechanisms of governance are on our side. My experience is the opposite. In the decades and decades that I've worked in communities around the country, working with people who set forth to stop some corporate or government harm and assault, and to replace that with what they want, the very first and the strongest barrier they run into is the law. That the law is most often on the side of the corporation coming into assault the community or the government enabling that assault to happen. And, you know, you started off the conversation talking about regulation. The realm to which most folks, most activists are sort of channeled into is the whole regulatory realm, the realm of the National Labor Relations Act and the realm of the Food and Drug Administration or the Securities and Exchange Commission. Or the National Environmental Policy Act and the EPA, you know, those realms are not about people exercising sovereign governing authority. They're, you know, just as the Attorney General in the early 1890s said, they become a barrier between the corporations and the people. And there's a mechanism to prevent the people from creating, you know, through organizing and educating and agitating and persistence, building the kind of temporary majorities they need in order to actually pass a law.
But why do you, actually, every the department that you mentioned or every law that set up different you know, commissions and what have you were a result of activism over the years, whether it's the EPA or the Wagner Act or any number of other laws. I mean, that the persistent popular revolt against things as they currently are does seem to have an effect, and maybe we're just at the point, say, the abolitionists were in the 1830s.
I disagree. I think the abolitionists in the 1830s were having very, very different conversations about what to figure out the nature of the problem that they were facing, and I think much healthier conversations because they were rooted in the basis of the they were studying the Constitution, they were studying law and legal theory. They didn't come up with a solution saying, well, we need a slave protection agency. You know, they said
yeah,
what
right.
we need is the
abolition.
Slavery. Slavery is a moral law wrong, a legal law wrong, a political law wrong. There's nothing good about that. And yet it is rooted and enabled and protected by the Constitution of the United States and by the laws of the land.
Exactly. And Supreme Court decisions like the Dred Scott decision.
So if we get the power, what we need to do is undo all that.
Right.
All right? In the last 40, 50 years, or 60, or 70s, I think for much of the 20th century and into the 21st, that people who are on the left, liberal, whatever, you know, progressive, liberal, left people, have believed mistakenly that the Constitution is on their side. And so when they organize and march and build their power, like the labor movement in the 30s, they built their power enough to pass a law, they got to a point where when that law was ready to be written, they lost control of that. It was written by the lawyers, you know, good liberal New Deal lawyers, and they sold them down the river. You know, there's, I think, historically a huge gap between when an emerging new majority is able and ready to force something to happen, then the law kicks in, the lawyers and the law kick in, and the original Constitution that laid out the framework and, you know, which also incorporated, you know, much of the English common law and stuff, which was, you know, hierarchical and dictatorial and tyrannical and certainly not about majority rule, all that kicks in. It's all there. And the new laws are written in such ways to undermine the alleged new power that this so-called movement put together.
And well, that always happens.
We've been channeled into these regulatory realms instead of saying, okay, we're going to change the nature of the fundamental nature of the relationship, say, between the employers and the employees.
Yeah, I mean, radical reformers throughout American history have always wanted more than what was ever finally wound up with. And in many ways, the reforms were used to affirm and extend the system they were revolting against. I mean, certainly, though, it is better to have an 8-hour day than a 14-hour day and what have you. But I don't know. maybe we, I do want to get to some other things, but I was thinking, I mean, slavery is embodied in the Constitution. Even the slave trade was allowed up till 1803, although it certainly continued after that. Supreme Court decisions upheld slavery. So I think that's essentially what I meant. I mean, right now, the powers of government are arrayed against the power that should be in the hands of the people, or a system of government and economy that benefit the majority of people, not a very, very small minority. And we get the trickle downs when it's actually even trickling down, which it isn't right now. So again, what seems to be missing is the component of the people in motion. And if we at the end of it all wind up with only getting half a loaf, well, again, that you know, we tolerated to begin with, and if we accept half a loaf, that's us again.
Well, I think the notion of the people in motion is essential. I mean, that's, you're quite right. That's the only activity that has accomplished anything. But I think we can aspire much higher, that each movement needs to aspire much higher in what we want to accomplish. And I think, you know, for me, fundamentally, we need to say, I've made the decision for myself and the people that I work with, we're not working anymore in the regulatory realm. I mean, that's not a place, I have no interest in the president's new proposed financial consumer protection agency. It's going to be another barrier. It's not going to, you know, it may accomplish a few nice things, but it won't accomplish anything close to what people need. I'm not out to improve the Environmental Protection Agency or the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act. I think those are, you know, we have empirical data by now, and those are barriers, and they're preventing us from even thinking about, much less talking and organizing and advocating about, severely limiting the privilege and authority under law that corporations have. That's what we, you know, why should it be that when, if you work for a corporation, you go to work, when you cross the threshold of the corporate property, you give up all your constitutional rights, and you have absolutely no say. You have no free speech. You have no freedom of assembly. You have absolutely no say in the work that you do and what's made and how it's made and the organization of work and the technology, what the product is used for, whether it makes any sense to be using that, to be making that product and shipping it all over the world. You have no say. The community, you know, has no say.
Now, Richard Grossman, a friend of mine, one time he worked at a company, and he was putting a sign over the entrance as a practical joke that said, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter." And unfortunately, the boss walked up right at that moment. We only have a few minutes left. Let's talk about something that's on the agenda right now. And you recently wrote about it at commondreams.org. It was called Beware the Madoff Diversion. And Madoff was the guy, Bernie Madoff, the Madoff, off with billions and billions of dollars of people's money in a Ponzi scheme, in a pyramid scheme. And right now his lawyers are asking, please only send him to jail for 12 years, because if you send him for 20, it's a life sentence. 12 years might be. Why? I mean, he's like a poster boy for everything that's gone wrong with this out-of-control system. Why do you call it a diversion?
Well, I called it a diversion because he was one of the few corporate manipulators who actually broke laws. You know, most of what everybody else did was essentially legal. He broke laws and they caught him. It was like the WorldCom guys, the Enron guys. It's a wonderful opportunity to show that, you know, the law works. This guy was a miscreant. We caught him, we tried him, and we convicted him, and he's going to go to jail. Well, you know, there's no shortage of laws on the books for fraud and corruption and all that. That's not the essence of the problem. They'll always find the Madoffs, you know, eventually, and send them to jail. They could have been a little more attentive. But it's the stuff that's legal. If we really want to understand how the country works, we need to look at how much stuff that's going on that's legal, which is denying people rights, which is enabling, you know, a small number of people to concentrate wealth in their own hands, and which is causing harm to communities and the earth. And that's what we need to look for. So that's the diversion. So,
okay.
You know,
well,
it really does. I mean, does it really matter how many years he goes to jail, whether it's 12 or 20? I mean, I suppose it matters to some of the folks who got
burned,
got directly screwed. But there are bigger fish to fry, and that is why, you know, here we have this giant meltdown with a huge amount of suffering around the country. And the public debate and discussion about what happened and what's an appropriate remedies for what happens just are essentially not taking place.
Richard Grossman.
I'm much more concerned about that.
Unfortunately, I think the conversation we've been having probably hasn't been heard by too many people. These aren't the issues that are generally on the agenda. As you indicated, we have about 60 seconds left. Where is something happening? Where are you putting your efforts? Is there anywhere that people could link up with? Websites, groups? What can you tell us?
Well, right now I'm writing a book about all this, so I've kind of removed myself from daily stuff. I know that in many communities around the country over the last 6, 7, 8 years, there's been efforts and successful efforts to pass local laws that in fact challenge and undo some of the history we're talking about. That say in our jurisdiction, corporations, you know, don't wield the constitutional authority and power, and many of those laws are in place, and the significant thing is that the communities have had to go through significant conversation and education and, you know, soul searching to take them out of the regulatory realm and begin to say, well, what do we need to do that's really commensurate with the nature of the problem? So that's happening. People are having, you know, more and more, I think, discussions about history and democracy, about the Constitution. I mean, trying to figure out how we got into this mess, what are the myths that we need to let go of, and what are some of the more historical truths that we really need to pay attention to in order to rethink and reconceptualize the very nature of our political work.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, because having this conceptual sense of what's wrong and what has to be done is incredibly important. Richard Grossman, thank you so much for being on the show. I'll have a link to your article, Beware the Madoff Diversion, at Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Thanks so much for being on the show.
I appreciate it, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
On your Apple iPhone 3G, at the iTunes Store, download the free WRIF app. Connect with just one touch and listen to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Is it wrong that I was totally aroused by that?
Details at WRIF.com from 101.
Are you receiving monthly checks from a lawsuit you won? Are you having trouble paying your bills every month because the settlement money you're getting just isn't enough? Well, there is a way you can get the cash you need now, in one lump sum payment. For free information to see how much cash you can get, call Peachtree Settlement Funding now at 1-800-931-7654. Find out how you can turn your future structured settlement payments into the cash you need now, to get free of your credit card debt, to meet your rising mortgage payments, to pay your medical bills and other expenses. If you're receiving payments from a lawsuit, call Peachtree Settlement Funding. For your free information, call now, 1-800-931-7654. You have bills piling up that need to be paid now, so why wait any longer? Get the future money you have coming to you now, when you need it most. For your free information, call Peachtree Settlement Funding now at 1-800-931-7654. That's 1-800-931-7654. 1-800-931-7654.
Keep listening for your chance to win. You can unlock a brand new 2009 Harley-Davidson XL 1200 Nightster. Details at WRIF.com. Motor City Harley-Davidson's Harley Fest 2009. Also from Miller Lite and 101 WRIF. Everything's at rock.